high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever the time may be in all the time zones covered by this incredible program called Coast to Coast AM Weekend Edition. I'm Art Bell, and it's going to be actually an extended weekend edition because I'm going to be here Monday as well. Filling in for George, who is, well, actually, I'm not sure what he's doing, but he's off doing something very important, I'm sure. In a moment, Whitley Strieber, followed by Dr. Nick Begich, and there's a lot of changes in Harp. Boy, are they cranking up the power up north, folks. And so, if you don't know what Harp is, and you're interested in possible health effects for the average person, and what it might do to our climate, what it might do to people on the ground, what it might do... period. Well, you're going to want to stay tuned for that, and we'll try and explain it from the ground up. Worldwide at the moment, in Baghdad, just about one half of the Iraqi soldiers have sort of quit, deserted, left their post, said, this is not for me, and gone home, or whatever. So, as a result, the United States is considering raising their pay. Maybe they should add a little extremely hazardous duty pay or something. I don't know. We want them to go after the factions that have been going after us. And you would think that would justify a fair amount of money, wouldn't you? So since half of them are gone, we're considering paying more. And when I say we, I really mean we. The flu this year is frightening. We've been handling that here by pretty well isolating ourselves. And we were thinking of shooting people who got near the fence, but no, we're not going to do that. It's pretty bad, though. It's epidemic levels in more states than not at the moment. As bad as this year's flu season is, though, it has not yet become pandemic, but experts warn a pandemic is coming, inevitable, just a matter of when, what time. It's going to happen, quoting Dr. Greg Poland of the Mayo Clinic, for the American public in particular, I think it will be horrific, end quote, horrific. And of course, as you know, Keiko has gone fins up. For kids, Keiko the killer whale was the charming hero of Free Willy. For biologists, the focus of fierce debate on whether captive animals could be returned to the wild, Keiko, who died of pneumonia this week, never strayed far from humans. Even when we freed Keiko, Keiko didn't want to go. Keiko hung around until it was fins up time, and that's, I guess, this day. So 2 years after he was freed, that's it for Keiko. In a moment, a very special person, Whitley Strieber, who does a weekly streaming show on the internet, that began long ago and far in a land far away called Dreamland. And, of course, has written a bazillion books. War Day, my favorite of all time. God, I love War Day. I'm partial toward end-of-the-world type nuclear sort of thrillers, and that was a beaut if you haven't ever read it. Whitley, who has written Communion and just tons of books, is going to be here tonight talking about abductions, UFO abductions, recent cases, as a matter of fact, of both abductions and UFO sightings. A lot of stuff going on. It's really hot out there right now. And, of course, Whitley of our joint book, The Coming Global Superstorm. And a lot of you have, I'm sure, seen the trailer based on our book called The Day After Tomorrow. It's closer than you think. About May 28th, I think, is the date. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit, too. Coming up in a moment, Whitley Strieber. Here from, actually from the West Coast, I believe, is Whitley Strieber. Hey, Whitley.
Hey.
How you doing, buddy?
Well, I'm doing real good, and I am indeed on the West Coast. In fact, I'm going to be meeting next week with Roland Emmerich, the director and producer of The Day After Tomorrow.
Oh, are you really?
Indeed. And I've met him briefly already. He's a really, really good guy. And I have never seen anything of the movie but the trailer.
Me too. And
awesome. And he says, well, you know, those effects aren't even finished.
Yeah, I gasped. We watched the trailer, my wife and I, wow!
Everybody in the theater gasped.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, and, I wrote the novelization of it.
In other words, let's get this straight. We wrote the book upon which, in part, the movie is based, and now there's a novel that you wrote based on the movie.
Right, because the book is, the movie is not quite, it's not quite close enough to our book in terms of the story.
I wonder if,
The concept is there.
I wonder if now there'll be a movie based on your novelization of the book.
Maybe a musical.
A musical.
Well, I did that with Annie Mame. I mean, there was a book, then a movie.
Yeah, I like it. Global Superstorm, the musical.
But the novel, the script just read like a house of fire. It was awesome, and so I do know what it is. I mean, I've seen it, and I can't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I have promised not to, and they deserve that because they've spent a lot of money on this. And all I can assure you is, if you have 1 second of quiet time in that movie, I will be very surprised.
Uh-huh.
It's really going to be something else. And
well, they better hurry up and get it out May 28th, right? Because you know the way the weather's going right now, we'll be there before. Theaters will be empty. It'll be all over.
It's terrifying. I mean, you know, Art, this thing that happened last summer, that nobody really took much notice of, except it was sort of weird, and that was that it got the waters on the shore waters got cold all the way down into Florida, real cold.
Really cold, yes.
And that was because the North Atlantic Current moved, or really the Gulf Stream, moved far out into the sea, into the ocean,
mm-hmm.
meaning, that is to say, it got weaker and therefore shorter, and let the water all the way from the Arctic Ocean come all the way down the eastern seaboard of the United States. And if that is not an alarm bell, that the thing that everyone laughed at us about and scorned us about when we went out on the road about it, and that now science generally considers is true, is about to happen. I don't know what is.
Buddy, the warnings are everywhere. You know, it doesn't matter whether you look at what the sun is doing, what the earth is doing, the polar and the ice caps. Every aspect of our environment right now is saying tick, 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 tick. Hopefully the movie will be out before the event itself.
And maybe the movie will do some good.
We're here, though, pretty much to talk about, maybe it'll do some good, maybe. It certainly is going to be an excellent movie. Abductions is what we're really here to talk about, though.
That's
isn't
right.
It? And it's been, abductions and UFO sightings are through the roof, right?
That's right. They are, well, UFO sightings they're really, I'll tell you, it's interesting. The abduction reports are coming from different places, for the most part, than the UFO sighting reports. Now, in British Columbia, there's a real hotbed taking place of both. But in the Midlands of the UK, which is probably the UFO hotspot of the world in terms of sightings right now, to the point where people are even... cars are stopping on highways. There's during the day, they're having lots of public daylight sightings there. There are no abduction reports from there. And maybe it's just as well, because there's something kind of ominous about a lot of these stories.
Why would you even guess that UFO reports and abduction reports are geographically separate? Why?
Well, Art, for one thing, we always have the impression that there must be just uncounted numbers of aliens or whatever there are here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's the case. I think the numbers are smaller. I think the numbers might indeed be quite small. And the reason is that there's a kind of a quality to some of these cases that has a... there's a similarity to them, and they don't, like, you don't have 500 people reporting abduction experiences in the United States all at once.
Right.
Now, the way the thing is set up now, people knowing about my website, the Coast website, the National UFO Reporting Center. There are so many ways to report these things, and folks aren't embarrassed about it anymore. They'll report it if it happens to them. It's not happening. But when it does happen, it has a kind of a uniformly ominous tone to it. Like the things in British Columbia, they have the same character as some older UFO cases and some cases where people have happened upon cattle mutilations in progress and seen these alien eyes glowing. And I shudder to think I once saw such a thing in the woods near my house. Only at the time I was scared, but too curious to really consider it dangerous.
Whitley, what do you know about, specifically about what's been going on recently in BC?
Well, I think that there are, for example, I have followed this case of this one woman, Cynthia, and a friend of hers. The friend received a severe burn during, I'll back up a little bit and tell you the story of this. It's probably one of the best documented abduction cases in history. It happened last summer.
Sure, go ahead.
And she and this friend went out to stargaze late at night. They hadn't been together for a while, and it was something that they used to do and they enjoyed doing. And so they thought they'd do it again. It was about midnight. They went out onto a country road, and I think all roads practically are country roads around there. They were well north of Vancouver.
Right.
And they got out of the car, and they were getting ready to stargaze, and Cynthia shined a flashlight out into the woods to be sure there were no bears or anything around, which could happen up there. And she was very stunned to shine the flashlight on these glowing almond-shaped eyes, glowing green in the light, which really scared her. And she said to her friend, "Oh my God, get back in the car, get back in the car," because she didn't know what those eyes were. I mean, they were not bears. They were nothing like nothing she'd ever seen before. And they had, before they did that, they had seen, actually out of the car window, the reason they stopped was they saw a triangle of three lights moving through the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get out of the car, they see this, and when they're trying to get back into the car, it's like moving through moosh. They can't. They don't seem to be able to move very fast.
I didn't want to say anything, but I've heard this story directly from the mouths when I had Peter Davenport on, and you are relating it exactly as they did.
Well, exactly, because I know it by heart. But in any case, let me then follow up. Let me go past that story. If we've talked this story before, I think I might have even talked it on this show. It's been talked a lot, but there's a follow up to it, and the follow up is this: I have kept up with these people. And to give you an example of what happened, has been happening, one night, Cynthia is sitting watching TV, and suddenly, she's so cold, she's literally turning blue. She's exhausted, with absolutely no sense of ever having even left the room. She goes to the emergency room, and they diagnose her with hypothermia.
Hypothermia?
Yeah.
Really with hypothermia?
Yeah.
Oh.
In other words, she's been outside. But when? She has no memory of it at all. It's as seamless as the abduction itself was.
Isn't that interesting?
But here's the kicker. The next morning, her daughter gets out of bed and collapses.
Collapses?
Collapses because her knee hurts so badly she can't stand up. She has no idea. They take her to the emergency room. She's got an impact injury to the cartilage in her knee. She's fallen, and she has a memory of a dream where she was taken into some kind of a vehicle, and she didn't want to be in it, and she fought her way out of it and ran back home again in the dream. And apparently, the dream coincided in some way with reality.
Boy, it sure is interesting to hear these physical manifestations that you can put your finger on tied together with a story like this. When you hear that, it puts a much harder fingerprint on the story.
Because that's the difference between now and most of the stories in the past. I can tell you, I'll tell you a story in a minute from the past that I want to bring up some because I want to point out that this has been going on like this at a low level for a long time. The difference now is there are some very hot investigators out there who aren't like the old line UFO guys who used to say, well, if it doesn't fit my theory, I'll just quit the case. I'm not even going to think about it.
Mm.
These guys, they don't care. They just go out there, and they're experts at taking evidence. They know what they're doing. People like Brian Vike in British Columbia, Kenny Young in Ohio. These are young guys. They're a whole different ball of wax, and they're much more effective, frankly, than the old line investigators who used to just filter everything through their theories. That's not happening anymore. So we're getting better reports, basically. And like Vike, after these two people reported seeing the UFO, he immediately correlated this with witness events from the whole area and found out a lot of people had seen the UFOs at the exact same time these two women were being affected by this on that road. So he has a cross corroboration. They never used to do things like that in the past. They never think to. But it's awesome. And
I have been for a long time now struggling, really struggling, Whitley, with all the people who tell me, and there are many, that, you know, all of this is harmless and their presence here is real, but good, benign. They're trying to help out the human race. I can't find it, man. Not in these stories that I keep getting told. I don't find it.
Their presence here is complicated. It's not all good. I would not say it's all evil from my own experience. I got on this radio program a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, and I told why I now know for certain my abduction was real. And I know it for certain because of the way in which I was raped. Now, that doesn't strike me as being something that was being done to me by a real nice guy.
You poured your heart out.
Yeah,
and,
I did.
I'll tell you, I had about 5 million emails after we did that program, and everybody was clear on one point, and that is whether or not they believed it, and most did. Virtually everybody believed that you believed it.
Because I believe it.
Just because of the way you told the story. It was obvious. It was just obvious. But
what happened to me afterwards? That's the thing. I went for it. I realized about, I guess in February, this happened at the end of December, by the time I had exhausted the obvious medical alternatives, I figured that this might have really happened, and therefore it might have been awful. And at the time, remember, I didn't really understand what had happened. I was not clear, not like I am now. I didn't have the advantage of hindsight and listening to the hypnosis tape after years, after I was no longer emotionally impacted by it. But I decided I would go out in the woods at night and try to see. I mean, if I was in contact with aliens from another world,
yes,
it might be lousy, but God, what an incredible thing to have happen to me.
Sure, and so try to initiate contact.
And I did, and it was effective. But let me tell you, this is the next year now. By this time, I've gone and I've learned to sit in a certain place in the woods, and I've had what seems to be mental communication with them, although I'm not sure. I'm really could be playing with myself as far as I know. I don't know. One morning, I'm awakened by what sounded like a chauffeur, maybe, you know, a horn blowing. It's a sound, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And this had been kind of pre-planned, and I thought to myself, my God, this is happening. It's not in my head. So I had prepared. I had a heavy robe. I had heavy slippers. It was dead of winter. Threw them on and started to go down to the meeting place that we could arrange.
Mm-hmm.
In my mental meanderings, in the sitting out in the woods in the night, meditating. Halfway down there, I can see into the little clearing beyond the woods, the snow. There are people standing there, short, dark figures. I can see them through the trees. And beyond them, a gray mass, and I hear a noise. A big machine is down there. And I think, oh, my goodness, this is for real. I walk a little bit farther, and then I hear something that made my blood run cold. A voice in my head, like I was wearing earphones, saying, come on, come on. This
East of the Rockies, called toll free 1-800-825-5033.
Running out of patience that you could imagine.
We'll translate that to gosh darn.
Gosh darn.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I stop in my tracks because I am not going down to that voice. No way.
Well, see, that's what I mean. That kind of a voice. Whitley,
and
hold on.
When we come back, let me tell you what happened next. Are we?
Yeah, out? That's always the way you handle a program like this. You build right up, and then we'll be back. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. And we will be right back and hear the rest of this. Somewhere it's going to be near 2 a.m. in a half hour or so. From the high desert in the middle of the night on the weekend, this is Coast to Coast AM with Whitley Strieber, and I'm Art Bell.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good evening from the high desert. My guest is Whitley Strieber, and as Paul would say in a moment, the rest of the story. Once again, Whitley Strieber. All right, Whitley, let's pick it up.
Okay, we left off. I was returning, shall we say, to my cabin at a fairly rapid rate of speed after this situation had overwhelmed me with, frankly, the fear that I would, if I went down there, never come back. And I got to the door. I put my hand on the doorknob, and I heard from those woods the three most beautiful sounds in the form of three soft but echoing calls that echoed across the pre-dawn quiet that I have ever heard. They were awesomely beautiful sounds, like a disappointed angel.
Huh.
And I kept going because I figured disappointed angel or disappointed predator.
Yes.
I'm not ready to find that out. In any case, I've got a family in here, and this is damn real, and I was really moving at that point. I was thinking more in terms of shotguns, frankly.
Uh-huh.
I go into the house. I get back up into my bedroom. I sit on the side of the bed, and no sooner have I sat down than I felt someone come into that room. I did not see anybody. I couldn't see them, there were whatever, but it was a palpable feeling. It scared the living daylights out of me.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I knew, I was plunged into a reliving, and this is not a dream, it is not a memory, it was not a hallucination, it was a whole different ball of wax type of experience. A reliving of the moment in babyhood with the furniture in my mother's room towering around me,
really?
A moment I had never remembered, never. It was in the amnesia of babyhood. First walking.
Yeah.
Now, Art, am I telling you a story about something evil, something good?
I'm not sure.
Neither am I, or something we just do not even begin to understand. But here's a caveat. We have to look at what is there on the ground. People tell me, keep telling me, you've changed. You used to think this was really cool and fascinating.
Right.
Now you think it's evil.
Right.
That is not true. Only thing has changed is the reports. I'm like a weatherman. You don't say the weatherman's changed because he says it's stormy today and it was clear yesterday. The weather changed. I don't get reports of extraordinary experiences like that happening anymore now, today. The only thing left seems to be the rape.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. Cat mutilations. Cat mutilations have been, they were in the news just a few weeks ago in Denver and Salt Lake.
That is correct.
They sweep the country, in fact, the world. Linda Moulton House traced this thing all over the world, where cats are mutilated, cut up, and generally thrown back in the general area where they were found by something that seems to me, it might be happening, by the way, right now in Texas. I haven't been able to confirm this, but I was trying to just before I got on the air, but my brother told me that it's happening in North San Antonio. It happened about a year ago in Austin.
Well, you know, there are terrestrial explanations for this kind of thing. Well, I'll tell you something, Whitley. A lot of serial killers start as animal mutilators. Now, I'm not suggesting that's what this is because I know it's happening in mass.
It's happening in mass, but the problem with that theory is it's like the cattle mutilations. There's too many similarities and strangeness in the way the animals are treated. And in addition to that, it's how could a serial killer be killing cats all over the world? I mean, it beggars imagination.
Yeah, I know.
Linda's going to tell you about thousands of cases of this.
Yeah.
God help us if the serial killer ever graduates.
And I'm a cat lover, so I'd grab the proverbial shotgun, believe me, if I latched onto somebody doing that.
Only you could. But Linda talked to those cops in Austin after this happened. She's talked to many policemen after it's happened. And they are at their wits' end. They can't find out who does it. Nor can they really understand exactly what is done and what kind of instrument is used on these animals.
Well, all right, here's another more terrestrial explanation to at least consider. As you know, I frequently interviewed the late Father Malachi Martin, and he indicated evil was on the rise at just an unprecedented rate. And there are certain types of cults and evil cults that sacrifice animals.
Yeah.
Now, that's at least worth running by and thinking about, whether this kind of thing might be spreading. Some kind of horrid little sect might be doing something like this. I don't know. And then, of course, comes the alien explanation, where, frankly, I'd kind of put that one at the end of the line. Now, maybe it is more likely. I don't know.
Well, I think it is. I think it has something to do with this whole thing. I don't know what the alien explanation means, because I don't know if we know what exactly is happening. But I don't want to get caught in my underwear, because I'm trying to concentrate on something here. And that is the negative aspect, the negative turn
yes.
that this has taken
yes.
more recently.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of positive reports and the lack of reports of relationship. And that's another thing. I had a relationship. It lasted for years. It started, yes, with a very violent experience in 1985. It it went and peaked in 1998 with the meeting with the master of the key, mm-hmm. right, man I call the master of the key, in a hotel room in Toronto who gave me that little book I wrote called The Key, which I thought, I still think, is the most amazing thing that ever happened to me in my life. The things that guy said were awesome. And they were not, this man, I mean, I don't think he was of this world at all. To me, that was the peak of my whole
experience. Do you recall can you give us the highlights of what you were told or what information?
Well, sure. The whole book is about, in general, it is about the nature of the soul, but taken from from the point of view of the science that understands the soul. That where a science that has penetrated into an area which most of our scientists right now don't even believe exists any more than they believed electricity existed 300 years ago,
mm-hmm.
That they don't even know about. And the explanations are so clear and so cogent, you come to understand objectively what you need to do for your own soul. And that is the awesome thing about it. It has nothing to do with any religious beliefs, but it doesn't deny any either. I'll give you an example of the incredible clarity of this man. I asked him what sin was.
Mm-hmm.
He said just these four few words, denial of the right to thrive. Five words. And if you think about it, that is one of the most extraordinary and powerfully ethical definitions of sin you could possibly ever come up with.
Denial, I want to think about it, denial of the right to strive.
No, thrive.
Thrive. Well, okay, yeah.
Denying somebody thrive. Their right to thrive.
Thrive. In other words, to live. And to live to, not just to live, but to live to the fullest. In other words...
Yeah, to thrive.
In other words, for example, slavery.
Or slavery, or the would, way we... The
slavery
way we,
would be a sin by that definition.
A tremendous sin.
Yes.
Or denying... Look at, you go to... Africa, and he said also in there, we're all responsible not only for ourselves but for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The great theme of Christianity, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In that sense, it's a repeat, but denial of the right to thrive is a really new way of looking at
it. That really is interesting. You're right.
Yeah, and you go back to Malachi Martin's statement, and you look at what we're doing in this world to each other and from country to country and not just right now, but I mean just the past 100 years, there has been a gigantic upsurge in evil by that definition.
There absolutely has.
Absolutely. And maybe, just maybe, the Close Encounter experience is beginning to reflect that. I got a great, it wasn't an email, it was on one of my message boards today, a brilliant statement I have on unknowncountry.com, we've got message boards.
And, yes.
They're wonderful message boards. And it was a statement, this guy outlining one after another all of the things that we do all the time to each other and pointing out how these things relate to how alike the visitors' things are doing to us. In other words, they are coming in, like in the abductions, they are taking something from us. They are not telling us what it is. They are taking it and just sort of throwing us back, alive or dead, and obviously not caring at all about us. And we do that to animals and to each other all the time.
As we would step on ants.
Exactly. With the same kind of indifference. And are they treating us as we treat others? Would it improve if we got better? Or are they just simply
And another question for you is, are we getting better? I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I read a long book a couple of years ago by a scientist who was talking about how as societies became more technologically advanced, they must also become more ethically advanced. And I was thinking to myself, is he nuts? Didn't he notice the Nazis and the communists who used technology like gas chambers and the communications that we had back then as a means of propaganda and railroad trains, airplanes, all kinds of modern technology to create evil? I don't think societies get less evil as they get more technologically advanced.
Do you know what I think, Whitley?
I think the opposite.
There are, this may be the wrong way to put it, but cycles of evil. Hitler was certainly a cycle of evil, and then there are kind of rest periods in between. And right now, you can feel it. The word you used earlier was palpable. It's palpable. You can feel in society a societal change. People are more on edge. People are, frankly, weirded out more.
They are. And, well, I'm noticing it in the letters I get on my website.
Yeah.
I've written a couple of journal entries. I have a journal on the website, and I will add, by the way, so don't write me emails asking me where it is. Please just click on the button that says MindFrame on the top of unknowncountry.com, and you'll find my journal there immediately, and my wife's journal, by the way. I've been writing about these negative things that are happening in the Close Encounter experience and trying to relate to them and to make some sense of them.
Yes.
Because, people are saying, well, we need to arm ourselves. And I'm thinking to myself, how, what do we do? If this is really bad, what do we do?
Well, people don't like bad news, Whitley.
And I know they don't.
They really don't. And if you tell them that the alien presence may well be negative, they react poorly to that. And they generally, as you found out, try and shoot the messenger.
Right. Well, I've been shot as a messenger for a long time.
Yes.
Ever since War Day. I know what that's like.
Yes.
Boy, I got shot down like crazy with that one on Good Morning America and every other place. And then 2 years later, they published this doctor, Kostasipas, who supported me on War Day. He definitely did, very openly, and it was great. He published a paper showing it was all true and referred to it as the War Day scenario. and but of course, I didn't get back on Good Morning America to refute what they said at all. But.
Well, and then, of course, we both took it in the side on Global Superstorm.
From Matt Lauer,
Matt Lauer. But there was an answer to that one, and so that all worked out well. I'm not a prophet. I don't know if you consider yourself a prophet, but it is eerie sometimes, Whit, to think of the things that I've talked about over the years that I've told everybody I felt was coming. A lot of them are already here. It's already happening.
It is already here, a lot of it, yeah.
But even through that, I don't consider myself any sort of prophet. I don't know about you, just intuitive, and just generally intuitive, that's all. And I think that's the general population. They can feel it.
I just look at what's there. I don't filter things out. I mean, that's why in the earlier days I was saying there was a lot of good in the Close Encounter experience. It was possibly dangerous at times and very heavy, and there were things that I knew and that I talked about that had happened that were pretty scary. But basically, there was not too many people getting hurt. I can't say that anymore.
When something is unknown, it tends to produce, in the average human, fear. Unknown equals fear. And so I'm not saying that it's definitely evil, but I'm saying it's a definite possibility. And even that's enough to get people upset. But based on...
It's not a possibility. There's evil in it.
Well,
you can see it.
Yes. I've been listening to these stories for years upon years upon years on the radio, and I didn't come to this conclusion slowly or easily, but rather through just listening to people. And I understand that sometimes people interpret what happens to them or others through their own religious filter. I don't have that handicap because I'm not particularly religious. So I look at it straight on, and I've seen as much or more evil or negative aspect of this whole thing than I have positive. So that's it, folks. It's possible the whole thing is rather negative for humanity, and we might as well realize it. And to me, it's even negative if it's sort of benign in the sense that we would feel about an anthill when we step on it. If it's just that benign, that's still possibly dangerous for mankind, period.
You know, Art, I have to tell you that when I kind of took the bull by the horns with this thing in my own life, and this was all over me. It was all over me. did change for the better. There's, like, if you talk to one of the old line UFO investigators, and I had a friend of mine actually went up to one of them at a conference just a couple months ago and said, I have a way of making this close encounter thing better. He immediately said, if it involves meditation, I don't want to hear about it. But that's not true. Actually, I used meditation for years as a means of communicating with whatever was out there and shaping my experience. And it was effective. It was effective. I'm trying to remember where it is on my website. Yeah.
Of course it's effective. It's like prayer or mass meditation on an event occurring. It's a gigantic power that I am not sure I want to explore any further right now until I can manage to understand more about it, because it's very powerful.
Very powerful. But it worked well for me. And what I was going to say is, I won't belabor it, but if you press on listen now on my website, on the right side of the homepage, mm-hmm. the very bottom thing on the list that comes up, it spawns a Windows Media Player. You have to have that to work it. Is a meditation about protection. It is the meditation that I used for years that my experience stopped being negative and became, I wouldn't say positive, but became damned interesting. Mm-hmm. And it ceased to seem dangerous after about the first year or so. And I think it was effective. And so that's there. That's what I have to offer.
Okay. That and a whole lot more on your website, which is, and I depend on it heavily for interesting information, unknowncountry.com, right?
That's right. Daily news of the edge every day.
All right. Well, as I always do, I really want to thank you for being here, and we will have you back on a regular basis because, frankly, you're fascinating. Whitley,
thank you, Art.
Thank you.
Well, it's mutual.
Good night.
Good night.
And once again, the movie springing from our book is The Day After Tomorrow. You can see the trailer now, and it's pretty awesome. Yes, indeed. Based in part on our book, The Coming Global Superstorm. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Coming up in a moment, Dr. Nick Begich, and we're going to talk about Project HARP up in Alaska, because they're getting ready to, actually right now, they're cranking the power up. And when they say crank it up, they really mean crank it up. We'll be right back. Reporting building high atop the Metroplex, the corrupt Metroplex. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Coming up in a moment is Dr. Nick Begich. We're going to learn all about HARP, and I'm going to assume that a lot of you know nothing about HARP. HARP may affect your life, and so you should learn all about it. That opportunity coming up in a moment. Stay right where you are. Here to tell you, as a ham operator, the shortwave frequencies and the radio spectrum have been really weird lately, even after the sun let up taking giant shots at us for a while. It still is very bizarre up there. Dr. Nick Begich, coming up, is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He's well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Nick received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in November of 1994. He is also the editor of Earth Pulse Flashpoints, a new science fiction book series. Nick has served as an expert witness and speaker before the European Parliament and has spoken on various issues for groups representing citizens' concerns, statesmen, elected officials, scientists, and others. Here from Alaska is Dr. Nick Begich. Doctor, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you again, Art. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. And a lot has occurred in between now and then. And so, you know, I'd like to kind of start from the beginning, Dr. Begich. What does the acronym HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, stand for?
It stands for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, which is actually a joint effort initially of the Air Force and Navy in Alaska.
Okay. And what is HAARP physically, and what is HAARP supposed to do?
Okay, HAARP is essentially a field or an array of antennas, and what they're designed to create is converting electrical energy into radio frequency energy, and then by utilizing this field of antenna, which presently there are 48 antenna on the ground, and by focusing or firing these antennas in a very specific way, you can focus or concentrate radio frequency energy into a relatively small area in the upper reaches of the atmosphere, in an area above the atmosphere called the ionosphere. And this is a highly charged area, and it's responsible for a great degree with the quality of communications in the country. When solar activity, for instance, happens, this area gets disrupted. Communications also get disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to sort of the roots of HAARP, it's really in the beginning was about looking at the ionosphere and ways to understand it and also ways to control it. And that's where HAARP starts to take on all kinds of dimensions not really looked at in the past. Ideally, from a military's perspective, this instrument on the ground would concentrate radio frequency energy and be able to manipulate that energy in such a way as to change the character of the ionosphere itself, virtually making it part of the machine that is on the ground.
Now, why would anybody want to do this, Doctor?
Well, there's several things that come up in the literature. Firstly, the most obvious from a military perspective is being able to control the ionosphere. For instance, if you could artificially create havoc in the ionosphere in such a way as to deny an adversary, for instance, being able to use any of their wireless communications, and yet because you're operating the system and you understand what you're doing to the ionosphere, you could also carry your own communication signals while denying everyone else theirs. So as a sort of preemptive measure for knocking out an opponent's ability to communicate, that was probably the first fundamental area that military researchers began to look at.
Well, you know, that sounds really military, but my early memories of the explanation for HAARP had nothing to do with the military. The military, well, they were said not to really be involved.
Well, that's going back to when let's go back to the companies that began this project, because I think that kind of starts to sort out some of the mystery about this project. It originally started with Atlantic Richfield, which is a large oil and gas company at the time that controlled trillions of cubic feet of natural gas on the North Slope of Alaska. And what
right.
they were interested in doing was finding a way to sell that gas or market that gas, and there's no pipeline to bring that gas down from the North Slope into the lower 48 states. So what they were looking for was maybe a way to just use it right where it was. And then arriving on the scene was a gentleman, Dr. Bernard Eastland, who incidentally is a pretty good guy. I've talked to him lots over the years. And he, as a physicist, began to look at this concept and said, you know, if we took that natural gas and we converted it to electrical energy and then we converted that to radio frequency energy, there's some ideas he had about weapons applications that might even create a global shielding effect. But all of that was kind of hidden away, and the things that came out...
So are you saying it was really part of the early Star Wars thinking?
Absolutely. It goes back to the mid-80s and even a little bit before, because what happened in the mid-80s, there was a guy named Ramos, who was one of the founders of TRW, and he was one of the first people that Dr. Eastland went to more or less pitch his concepts of this new weapons technology. And Ramos immediately zeroed in on this global shielding effect. And
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me just for 1 second stop you. I'm trying to imagine how you might take electricity, and of course you can convert it to radio frequency, to RF, But then what? I mean, was the idea to transmit it then to another location and reconvert it, or?
Oh, no. Coming straight off of the antenna array, or this field of antennas, by firing them in a specific way. Normally, like people listening to us tonight, they're listening via radio, and as that energy comes off of the antenna, it spreads out and gets very, very less dense very rapidly.
It starts off, of course, as a very narrow signal, AM or FM, and becomes broader and broader as it leaves the antenna. That's the normal way things work. Now,
right.
HARP works the other way around, right?
HARP is much different, because what it does is create what's called a cyclotron resonance, which if you could visualize it, it would look like kind of a corkscrewing motion of energy coming off of this field of 48 antenna, and that would focus the energy or concentrate it to a relatively small area. So it would be by analogy, if you think about what a flashlight does versus what a laser does.
Yes.
The same kind of analogy in this case with radio frequency energy instead of light.
The flashlight broadens out, of course, as we all know. And a laser maintains a very narrow beam. A HARP, of course, starts out as a slightly wider beam and becomes very narrow. But again, you're saying this then was envisioned as a way to use these resources, convert them to electricity and then to RF, but always thinking about a shield-type weapon?
Well, that wasn't out in the front of the public initially. Initially, they
right.
were talking about things like shunting energy out of the ionosphere for use in powering the electric grid, as an example, because there's tremendous potentials. In fact, when Senator Stevens from Alaska went forward in the floor of the Senate, he talked about this as something right out of Jules Verne, that we'd be able to tap the ionosphere for an endless supply of energy and solve the problems of the world. And, you know, and that was quickly discounted by scientists, and contrary to Stephen's normal behavior, he would have just axed the program. In this case, he didn't. He, in fact, funded the program and continued to fund the program even to this day.
Was that all a facade at the beginning, or was it genuine in the beginning and simply quickly got converted?
Well, I think it was genuine. I mean, Senator Stevens is not someone that makes statements like that without some forethought and without some advice from a lot of very well-informed individuals. So I think initially, as a project, that was something that people were considering. As the military moved into this project, things became much different. And they initially had it all up fronted by the University of Alaska Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks as if it were just an academic exercise. And, you know, that quickly dissipated, and it became clear that those that were really running the show were, in fact, the military, when they started utilizing for all public comment a PR guy out of Hascom Air Force Base, who you might remember as John Hexer, someone we tried to get on the air to have a little
yes.
bit of discussion and open debate on this subject.
Yes. Well, you know, I did, as you well know, I did have somebody on. Or did I? Maybe that was NASA. No, I guess I never did. I guess we never did get anybody on, did we? We tried.
I think that the issue was they just didn't want to have an open debate,
yeah.
and that was too bad because, you know, we had, at least at one occasion, we had them in a debate in front of our state legislature in Alaska.
I think you and I talked with one of them perhaps on the telephone trying to get them to do it or something along those lines.
It seems to me that we were making a lot of attempts, and what we kept running into was they might consider going on as long as they knew what was coming in advance and
that kind of
thing, and, you know, that's not the way to talk about these issues. You know, you either have some knowledge or you don't. And these guys are on the inside of the program, and either they know their program or they don't. And, you know, the way we looked at it from the very beginning was, you know, in fact, in the very first article I wrote on this subject, because of my family's relationship with the senator, I sent that article in advance to him and his staff through a staff person that had been originally on my father's staff when he was in the Congress, with the idea that if there was some flaw, some fatal flaw in what we were considering, that at least he would have an opportunity to tell me what that was, and I would be more than happy to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only time since my father's disappearance years ago that we never got a response from the senator's office. And it really started to set the stage for what became, for us, a bit of a combat with Stephen's office in terms of how we were approaching this. Because we did not intend, and nor do we ever intend, to undermine security. Our issue was that the side effects or the other effects of this device were things that the public really needed to be involved in.
Well, of course, we'll get to all of that. Now, recent headlines, I remember that you originally told us the ultimate goal of HAARP was to actually raise the power levels being used to something like a billion watts.
That's correct.
And I just saw some recent headlines indicating that there had been some funding that had occurred or something or another, and that, in fact, they were in the process of upgrading to, four times the power they're running now or something like that.
Yeah, they're going from 48 antenna to 180, and eventually the goal was 360. And the idea is to create one gigawatt or 1 billion watts of effective radiated power. And that, and the important thing to remember here, and this is where we get into the debate with these guys, they're the ones who publish that information. And then they want to play games with what that means. And so what they've argued with us about is they talk about the input power. And we're not talking about the input power when we're talking effective radiated power. We're talking about the effect of that power at the point in which they're trying to create a reaction, which
that's
is
right.
in the ionosphere.
That's right. Let's explain the difference. Effective radiated power is the totality of the actual power you have with the gain of your antennas. So you start off with a certain amount of power, but if you have enough of an antenna, you begin to effectively get more and more and more, and you can continue to double the amount of power. So they can talk about anything they want, but the ERP, or effective radiated power, is really what we have to talk about because that's reality. That's what's really going to hit the ionosphere.
Right, and this is where the action is. And when you think about the ionosphere, there's some other things that were discovered sort of along the way before HAARP was fully engaged. And one of those things was that if you pump energy into the ionosphere in just the right way at the right frequency, that it actually acts as a catalyst, actually drawing energy or causing energy to be released that's naturally available in any case. In this case, they were using VLF, a very low frequency signal, and they found out that when it hit the upper reaches of the ionosphere just below the next layer, the magnetosphere, it actually amplified by up to 1,000 times. And that was not energy coming off the ground. It was more like energy like what would be the equation of the primer on a bullet. You know, it's not the primer that does all of the action. It's the gunpowder that the primer triggers. And the same thing was being discovered was that you could send energy up in very specific window frequencies and trigger releases of natural energy that was available, causing a much, much greater effect. So you have this huge transmitter on the ground that's very versatile, and then you have the ability then, if you know what these instabilities are, where you can trigger these events, then you have something that's even much, much more powerful and profound in terms of a technology.
Well, so should we not assume, that is the general public, that since this is continuing to be funded and is a very active project growing indeed and all the rest of it, that there is something to all of this? I mean, they're not going to just, much as our government wastes money from time to time, they're not going to be throwing money at nothing. There is something big going on here.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go back to the early days of all of this debate, back in 1996, the funding for HAARP was under nonproliferation and counterproliferation in the defense budget because one of the applications, one of the uses, was this idea of what's called earth-penetrating tomography, which in plain language would be like looking into the earth or, by analogy again, X-raying the earth or seeing those layers, underground shelters, or structures underneath the ground.
But the implication of that is that they get the signal back kind of like radar.
Right. And what they would do is they would send the high-frequency signal up to the ionosphere, but they would pulse that signal. And what would happen is the ionosphere itself would begin to harmonize with that pulse rate. So it acts as like it would convert from DC to an alternating current, and it would actually send a signal back to the Earth in this ELF range, which would penetrate the Earth and then reflect a certain amount of that signal back, which could be analyzed for earth-penetrating tomography. And on a program called Horizons, which is a BBC program similar to what we have in the U.S. as NOVA, this program, actually they interviewed Papadopoulos at the University of Maryland, one of the principals involved in this particular use, and he said that after the Congress mandated this demonstration, they actually proved with 99% accuracy that this application would work by looking at underground, known underground mining structures in the area
sure.
of these facilities and being able to deduce what
But
was
the
possible.
Implication of this is that the RF radio frequency that you send to the ionosphere that then bounces off has got to be strong enough to penetrate the ground, right? And then, and not only penetrate the ground, but then return.
Right. And what we're talking about is it's basically not so much the amount of energy going in, because there are others who have used earth-penetrating tomography, like a gentleman by the name of Brooks Agnew, who actually ran around with a company that all of us know today called Halliburton.
I know, but that's a localized phenomenon. In
right.
other words, they're doing that right there to the ground. We're talking about bouncing off the ionosphere and then hitting the ground.
Right.
And so that's a very, very different kind of thing, because coming back to the ground, you're going to encounter, before you get to the underground bunkers and tunnels or whatever, you're going to get to human beings.
Right. And this is problematic, because the ELF range...
Yeah.
Is in fact the same range of frequency that our brains operate on. And what we have learned about the brain is it's not so much the intensity of the signal as it is the frequency of the signal that can
right.
cause dramatic and different effects that are basically, I won't say unexpected, because many in the scientific community now understand what's happening, but certainly in the classical training that many scientists get in the life sciences, it's sort of out of the context of what they're used to seeing. And I think that's the difference between the physicist and the life scientist, if you will. They look at things much, much differently.
Theoretically, what kind of effect on the brain and then consequently human behavior might there be?
Well, it's not even theory anymore. It's a fact. Actually, at Yale University, what was discovered by a gentleman by the name of Jose Delgado in the mid-80s, he used radio frequency energy at 1/50th of what the Earth naturally creates, and was able to influence the behavior of humans and primates, from changing them from lethargic and passive to highly aggressive, almost like flipping on and off a light switch.
Huh.
And that was done with no physical contact, no implants, nothing, just RF in the right frequency range. That is pretty dramatic. And let's put that in perspective. The Earth naturally creates an amount of RF. This is at 1/50th. What's around us right now at this moment is about 200 million times what the Earth creates, just by what man creates.
Wow.
And yet, in a coherent signal within the right frequency range, you can trigger this kind of cascading effect in terms of brain chemistry, causing huge, huge changes.
Would the implication there be that what the Earth emits normally affects our behavior? Hence, if the radiation from the Earth were to in some way change, our behavior would change with it. Would that be?
Well, not necessarily, because the Earth, the energy coming off of the Earth is not necessarily a coherent signal. It's more random and scattered across the a range of the spectrum. We're talking about a man-made signal that maintains a pulse rate for a specific period of time to allow those reactions to occur, something that nature normally doesn't do. A good example of this, and to take it on a different scale, you know, people think about a television set as being pretty harmless. You know, you sit back 10 feet from the TV and you're watching the television, and the light emitting from the TV is very low density by the time you're 10 feet away. I mean, there's not much energy striking you.
Right.
Yet, if you remember back in Japan a few years back, around 97, there was this episode where these kids were watching a cartoon and 700 of them went to the hospital with epileptic seizures.
That's right.
And it wasn't the amount of energy, it was just the pulse rate or the coherent signal that was coming off the TV that was maintained for just enough time, that flicker rate.
To set them off. All right. Doctor, we're here at the bottom of the hour. Hold on just a second. We're talking about HARP, a project up in Alaska, which could actually directly affect all of us. We'll be right back.
Tell me what you say. Don't you love her badly?
to talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
You know, actually, Art could make a claim just like that, from coast to coast and worldwide, because what they do has exactly that kind of reach. What they're blasting up from the ground in Alaska to the ionosphere has exactly that kind of reach. That's what we're talking about. Dr. Biggage, would it be possible to take a very active, very aggressive, even military person and have them become lethargic?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's, you know, when you look at what's happening in terms of military science right now, this is one of the big initiatives. It's not just about HARP. HARP is just one of many, many systems being developed that essentially utilize energy for a number of weapons applications, including debilitating troops in the field by using energy as the base rather than bullets and bombs.
Or even potentially set up a state where the person's nearly frightened to death.
Absolutely.
So these are incredible possible applications, incredible. And as I mentioned, it's now being, the temperature is going up, so to speak, and they're really cranking it up there. What might we expect from this next level of energy that they're about to go to?
Well, you know, this is the area where we start to all speculate, including the scientists that are involved, and their sort of take on it is it's their plasma lab in the sky, you know, and that's actually, they have said that, you know, looking at this experiment, and the objective for them is to find that next level of stability after creating an unstable situation.
Other translation, words, then, they don't know. They don't know.
But here's, you know, when you get back to this idea of influencing behavior, you know, we took this issue up with the European Parliament several years ago. And as part of that, we took in the same concept of manipulating behavior. And as part of the resolution that eventually passed the European Parliament, they dealt with, three sections dealt with HARP. And then the fourth section of our area of that resolution dealt with this idea of manipulating human behavior. And I'll just read the one sentence because it's really revealing. And it says, it calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote. Now, to get a legislative body, a political body, to put that in print, you have to demonstrate an awful lot. And in that case, we did. We demonstrated a technology as well as provide the data that supported it. And this was unclassified data, material in the public domain, that convinced the European Parliament that this was possible and that this was possible with HARP. Now, since then, in 2002, back in August of 2002, the Russian Duma, their parliament or their legislature, passed a resolution in opposition to HARP for all of the straight military applications and this specific application, the influencing of behavior over large geographic areas. And this is more or less could be used for changing the emotional state, for instance, of combatants, making them fearful or anxious as opposed to confident and ready to fight.
Well, of course, we just had, and actually we're still having, an open conflict with Iraq. Do you think that any of this technology, is there any sign at all that HARP became particularly active during the recent Iraq war?
Well, if we go back a little bit, if we go back to Afghanistan, right after the 9/11 event, in November 27th of 2001, there was an MSNBC story suggesting that HARP be used in Afghanistan or a system like HARP for locating underground facilities. And nothing ever was heard after that. I mean, the story ran and then it went away.
Oh, no, I understand. But I know that you monitor, to some degree, the activity of HARP and get reports on it. Is there any activity that during that any period of time since or during the war, it became more active.
Well, you know, the thing that's happened with HAARP is they're not announcing much these days, but there were what they call engineering tests during some of these periods of time. And the problem is now sorting it out, which is an engineering test that's legitimate,
yes,
and which is just a way to hide what they're doing. And
yes,
the problem with so much of this is without independent monitoring, and that takes, you know, some equipment and some time and commitment, you know, there's not a whole lot that you can really deduce without that independent monitoring. The countries that are most apt and able would be the former Soviet Union, now Russia, because they had developed a certain level of technology. In fact, the predecessors to HAARP were Russian ionospheric heaters, which is what we used to call these things. And when you go back to the old Russian literature and you look at what was happening, you know, all the way up until the 1990s, the early 90s, they were still proposing, in fact, they were proposing to us a joint effort on missile shields, utilizing this exact same technology, and we refused. And then we come back around almost a decade later, offering them the same opportunity, and they refuse, leveraging their arguments for foreign aid and money and so forth, which, of course, is the nature of the way things work.
Okay, I have a question for you, related but not right on the mark. I'm a ham operator. In the last several months, a couple of months anyway, we've been noticing this incredible noise on the 40-meter band, this pulsing 100 kilohertz wide noise on the 40-meter band that comes and would come and go and come and go. And I got so upset about it, as did several of my friends, that I actually recorded it, or a friend of mine did, Jim, and I played it on the air. And for a couple of nights, I played it on the air. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, it disappeared for several weeks. It just went away after I did that.
Interesting.
And the question is this. Now, originally, I know you remember the Russian, we called it affectionately, the Russian woodpecker.
Right.
That was that a form of ionospheric heater?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Those were the early versions, and there were five of them in the former Soviet Union, and they're the ones that created that signal. And what we need to remember is HAARP is not the only transmitter like this on the planet today.
Well, my question continues. Let me finish it up. And so we thought, this new noise probably is some sort of over-the-horizon radar. But, gee, we don't need that anymore because we've got satellites, and the Russians have satellites, the Chinese have satellites, and that sort of replaced the need for over-the-horizon radar, looking for missiles that would be in the launch phase, that sort of thing. You could understand it. Well, once you got satellites, we wouldn't need it. Question is, are other third-world nations now beginning to experiment with this because they don't have satellites up there, but they'd still like to be able to look over the horizon? So is there experimentation going on in certain countries around the world?
Well, there's indications the answer is yes. I mean, in Canada right now, they have constructed a number of these facilities, not because of their lack of economy to support satellite technology, just because they have put these in conjunction with HAARP. In fact, Rosalie Bertel, who's a Canadian researcher, she's a physicist and an MD. She was a lead physician on the Bhopal incident, as an example, very, very well respected scientist. She actually published material in Great Britain on what was happening in Canada with their ionospheric heaters. And then if you look at what's going on in Europe, the ISICAT system is advancing. In fact, the Norwegians, their parliament has started to discuss this issue. We've gotten called in the last few months by media from that location. So there are other transmitters operating that may be responsible for this signal. The other consideration is third world development or proliferation of this technology. The thing about it is, it's when you get right down to it, and when I've had engineers look at the contracting documents, which are public records, there's nothing hidden about them, their reaction was, you know, the thing is pretty simple. In the idea, it's really developing the computer software to drive it. But that kind of technology is pretty flat. There's nothing here that you couldn't get literally off the shelf and recombine it to form a transmitter like this.
And what do you think they're really trying to do right now? In other words, are they still in the tunnel and bunker phase? Are they in the effect on humans phase? Are they trying to knock ICBMs out of, out of their trajectory? What are they bearing down on right now? What's our best guess?
Missile defense is the big issue right now. At least that's what's masking a lot of the funding. You know, missile defense, we said early on back, in fact, it was 8 years ago that we went on with you, 8 years ago this month,
And we said that this was a ground-based Star Wars system then, and we suggested in the course of all of our work that this would eventually lead to a new weapons system for missile defense. And in fact, if everyone has followed the news, we know that, you know, the ABM treaty has been abandoned by the United States, and we're building a missile defense system in Alaska, originally projected to cost $11 billion and then projected to be $65 billion, and now we're hearing numbers in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And what we're hearing about are special systems for detecting these incoming objects, which I believe a lot of that material and a lot of that research was done on the basis of what happened at HAARP. The other thing that we're hearing in the open literature is this story about silos. In fact, they're building the silos for the missiles to intercept missiles. I do not believe for a moment that that is going to be an effective system, and neither do most scientists that have been out there and looked at it for a variety of reasons. You know, they've had a number of tests, and about half of them have failed.
Right.
And these are under ideal conditions. And you have to consider how fast, you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile at its optimum speed re-entering is going to maybe get 30,000 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah. I heard a rumor, Doctor, that there was some hanky-panky going on with the testing in the sense that some of the test vehicles that were to be destroyed were transmitting some sort of signal that would enable the interceptor to home right in.
Right, and you know that one of the key scientists on that project quit.
Did you hear about that?
I've heard that story, but I haven't seen the documents. What I have seen
story.
Is
yeah.
the comments of the scientist that about a year or two ago quit because she said that they were manipulating the results to get positive results for the Congress. If you think about that, you know, what was most likely, in my view, where I think this is headed is not to missiles intercepting missiles, but electromagnetic weapon systems being used to do that. In fact, there's a United States patent by the Department of Energy from 1990, now 13 years old. It's patent number 4959559, and it would create a much different kind of discharge. It wouldn't be a missile leaving. It would be a ball of lightning leaving the discharge point that would travel at approximately 186,000 miles a second.
Huh.
Okay, so just to put that in perspective, you can go around the Earth seven times in less than a second at that speed. So this is tremendous velocities. Now you take a look at that concept, and you talk about energy weapons intercepting something with a great deal of precision. You've got a much different equation. With HAARP, What they showed is you could not only get this over-the-horizon effect to detect objects, but using special satellite-based technologies, using gamma-ray detectors in conjunction with HAARP, you could actually sort out which of those incoming objects would carry were carrying nuclear payloads.
The real McCoy from the decoys.
That's right. And this is something that scientists who have been opposing the missile defense system...
That's an awful lot of detail, Doctor.
Oh, yeah. But they've been saying that you can't do this. Well, in fact, you can. And the next thing you can do is you can increase the power, and this is what we can look forward to in the next phase of HAARP, is to be able to increase the power sufficiently to disrupt the controls of those objects coming in. In other words, to disrupt their computer by what's called an EMP or an electromagnetic pulse, a surge of energy that overrides those circuits. The thing about it is, HAARP isn't a precision kind of weapon where you can target, like, one object. You're going to hit the whole mass of everything within that area, including civilian planes and so on, which, you know, in a nuclear attack, I mean, the military has to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
Those are some of the tough decisions that someone one day may have to make.
I wonder how you test something like that.
Now, that's the real question. And how do you test a ball of lightning? And yet, think about some of the reports that you and I both have heard over the years coming out of primarily Australia, where they have these visual images of these balls of energy that seem to be traveling at tremendous velocities, almost too fast to even track.
I've seen them myself.
And this,
not in person, but I've seen videotape of them from space.
That's right.
And they're like ball shots of plasma that just rise at an unbelievable rate.
Yep, and this is exactly what the Department of Energy had patented all those years ago, and most likely more in line with what we're going to see in real missile defense. But now put that concept on top of this concept that the president has introduced, which is preemptive warfare. In other words, you can you can establish a weapon system that can fire off so many rounds so rapidly, you could basically bring down the infrastructure of a small country before they even had an opportunity to know they were being attacked.
Huh.
That's a startling shift. And when you think about some of the initiatives happening internationally with other countries right now in space, it starts to open the door to a whole lot of questions. It's not about a trip to the moon, folks.
Right.
It's about technical capability, because ultimately warfare and the war fighting platforms are going to move into space more so than they already have.
Do you have any indication how far along they are with such a weapon?
You know, given that it's a 13-year-old patent, I would say it's probably in the pretty advanced development stage. And when you think about what's in the public literature, is usually just the tip of the iceberg, including the patent record, because normally many of these kinds of patents never even make it into the public record.
Well, I know this. If we were hit by an electromagnetic pulse of sufficient size, the United States economy would be completely decimated. We have come to the point with computers and so many records being kept by computers that anything that would literally wipe everything out would stop the United States cold.
Absolutely. In fact, on a small scale, you know, they've used these for police departments and experiments to knock out the electronic ignitions of cars. You know, but you can scale that up to something that's hitting a whole hemisphere. You know, and that's what you're talking about when you're talking about HARP technology and the capabilities that go with it.
Would such a weapon of necessity have to be robotic? Wouldn't it be so dangerous for the people who, for lack of a better phrase, pulled the trigger? Wouldn't it get them?
Well, they set up HARP with one of the requirements in the contract was fiber optics for controlling it, so that you could control it remotely.
Oh, so they don't sit at HARP and run it; they remotely operate it.
If they choose to, absolutely. Especially where they have you're talking about the energy in the side lobes and energy that's going to hit
absolutely
people
just in the general area. Sure.
Yep, and this is how they avoid that. They basically any of the high energy tests would be done remotely, so they're out of the field of harm. At least
what are HARP's favorite frequencies? What range do they operate in, Doctor?
You've got me where I'm not sitting with documents that I can refer to, but it's essentially a high frequency signal. But I can tell you this is the primary range is only one component, because what showed up in the literature is that it affects potentially either primarily or secondarily, depending on the effects you create. It covers 16 decades of the spectrum, which goes from ultra low to visible light. They can trigger everything within that range by just manipulating the signal on the ground.
I recall you telling me about a harmonic relationship that they would start, or they would modulate with some sort of extremely low frequency signal, and then another low frequency signal, and then there'd be the sum and the difference of those two that would produce some outrageous cascading effect.
Okay, this is actually where they send the VLF energy up into the upper reaches of the ionosphere. And what they know happens at that point is the way it couples, it actually releases energy of 1,000 times more power to the energy that was just delivered. The same equation, a good analogy would be like if I put dominoes from here to Paris and I increase their size, say 1% with each domino. But I hit the first one with just a flick of the finger. You know, by the time they hit Paris, there's one the size of the Eiffel Tower crushing it. Now, it wasn't my flick of the finger that did that any more than it was the HARP signal hitting the ionosphere. It was the release, in this case, of the dominoes, gravitational energy that was already available. In the case of the ionosphere, it's releasing energy that's already there, energy generated from the sun interacting with our magnetic field lines. and that's what they're triggering. So you're talking about being able to hit those specific window frequencies. And these are the instabilities that they're looking for. They're trying to find where are those signals that we can send up to draw this energy into the game so that we have a much more powerful and violent reaction.
Doctor, is there any possibility that HARP could be used to affect our climate?
Absolutely.
All right. When we get back, the absolutely part is where we'll pick up. Because heavens knows there is quite a bit going on with the climate right now, isn't there? Very odd indeed out there. Think that could all be happening from Alaska? Well, may be. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM in the Nighttime.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
By the way, this song, Matisse, is the group that does it. And, well, she's really something. She's French, African, and singing as well in English, if you listen very carefully. It comes from the show Dead Like Me that was running on Showtime, and somebody sent in an email and said, you know, they knew that I love that show, Dead Like Me. And so they're saying that there's going to be some kind of Dead Like Me marathon beginning Monday the 15th on Showtime. So if you missed this show, which I know a lot of you did, check it out on Showtime. You've got to see it. It's called Dead Like Me. You'll hear this theme in a couple of the episodes. It's really an excellent, excellent show. As is the one that we're doing right now with Dr. Nick Begich. Subject, harp. And our weather coming right up. So hopefully you've got an idea of what it is that harp is. It's this high-energy radio frequency blast that's sent up to the ionosphere for various stated goals and reasons. And one of the possibilities that we just asked about prior to the top of the hour was affecting our weather. To which Dr. Begich said, absolutely. I would love to understand, or even try to understand, the dynamics between high-frequency RF to the ionosphere and some or any effect on the weather. How would that, or how might that occur, Doctor?
Okay, looking at just the mechanical idea of heating the ionosphere, and what happens in that heating is interesting. Is you, above HARP as it's currently configured, you can heat an area about 30 miles in diameter.
Huh.
And you can lift that area. By heating it, it pushes it further out. And so you push out what would look like a column going out maybe as far as an additional 200 kilometers. So you're talking about changing the local atmospheric conditions, because when you push this hole, the lower atmosphere moves in to fill that space.
Hmm.
And what that does is it alters the local pressure systems, and it also alters jet stream flow.
So
just as a mechanical activity. Now, whether or not you can trigger other things with electrostatics or using the electricity or the electrical radio frequency energy itself and triggering things, there's some question about that, because Russians have been doing this work for years. In fact, in the last 2 weeks, I was called by the it was the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that was interviewing me for an article on weather modification taking place in South Texas, where they brought in a bunch of Russian specialists using, I believe they're using electrostatics. That's what they have announced.
Is that so?
Yeah.
The Russians made, as you know, all kinds of interesting claims, like being able to create cyclones,
right,
to put out fires in Southeast Asia and all this baloney. And I was wondering, and you're saying there's electrostatic technology behind it?
Yes, and that's according to the articles that came out in the late 1990s on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But again, looking at this sort of mechanical way of heating the ionosphere and lifting it, there was an issue of Scientific American that was published, I believe it was in May of 2000. It might have been May 2002. But you can tell because the whole issue is dedicated to weather. And about midway through is a map of Alaska, and it shows the jet stream traveling through south central Alaska. And at one point, it takes a dogleg north about 50 miles, then goes east about 75, and then south about 50 miles, and travels on its way.
Mm-hmm.
It coincidentally, and I say coincidentally because there was no independent monitoring of HARP, this dog leg occurred right above the HARP facility.
Well, son of a gun.
And here's what it did. It moved weather fronts out of East Texas and Louisiana into central Florida and dropped a couple of tornadoes right in the city of Orlando a few years back.
There you are. In other words, the jet stream, I'm sure on your local stations, folks, you've seen your weatherman depict the jet stream, and it's kind of like a big, long snake, and it curls around frequently, dips way down south, cuts up across a lot of times right where I am here in Nevada, and then north across the country, and then starts dipping down again when it gets to the east coast. And it, you know, it shifts and moves around, and wherever the jet stream is, there's always weather action going on right below it, it seems like. And so if you were to change this snake way up north, then it would whip around down south, wouldn't it, Doctor?
That's right. And the thing about this is again, it's unpredictable in terms of what it really does, because we're not capable of modeling the entire system and understanding all of the intricacies of how it works. One of the things I pointed out to the reporter from Texas that was interviewing me, she goes, well, this is really a good thing. You know, we're going to get rain in an area we haven't had. And I said, okay, well, you tell me when 1,000 communities do this all over the world and it disrupts the weather for everyone else on the planet and maybe denies rainfall where it otherwise would go, how would we feel if all of a sudden, say, the country of Canada decided to increase its rainfall and it ended up depriving the rest of the lower 48 United States of its normal precipitation, causing our crops to fail? How would we feel about that? Well, we would consider that an aggressive act. In fact, it would actually violate an international treaty signed by the United States in 1978 when it was ratified, which was a treaty that said we would not modify the weather except for peaceful purposes. Now, that gets a little squirrely because
what's a peaceful purpose? Well, to us it might be lots of rain in Oklahoma or, I don't know, in Kansas where they need some rain or something. But from the Canadian point of view, it wouldn't be peaceful at all.
Right, and that's exactly right. And now the other point that comes up is Eastland actually did more work in the weather modification area. He actually had a contract from the European Space Agency that turned into a peer-reviewed paper that would utilize HARP-type instruments for knocking out the energy contained or redistributing the energy contained in tornadoes. And here's the way he envisioned that working. He would use the ionospheric heater to actually, you know, when tornadoes form, it's a cold front hitting a warm front, and it creates a shearing action that causes that twisting to begin. And
yes,
so,
sir.
The more extreme the difference in temperatures and so on and just a whole lot of factors, you can actually see that go from, say, a 2 to a 4, depending on, you know, what that energy exchange is looking like.
Yes.
Now, if you could heat up the part that was cold to keep that shearing action from happening in the first place, maybe you could stop that tornado from forming. In fact, you would stop it.
Or conversely.
Or just the opposite. What if you miss or miscalculate and you heat up the already area that's warmed,
yes,
creating a greater difference and a more extreme reaction instead of getting a class 1, maybe you get a class 4 tornado out of it. Now, that wasn't lost on the United States when that work was done for the European Space Agency, and Bernard actually got a contract with FEMA, interestingly enough, and NASA to demonstrate or at least to analyze the possibility of doing the same thing using space-based lasers, for instance, to create the heating effect. And that work was actually completed as well. The point is what's happening, and this has been raised with the last three secretaries of defense, this discussion about even abandoning this old treaty on the basis that the technology now is becoming so desirable from a military perspective that they'd like to advance it.
And well, while I would like to believe, Doctor, that we adhere scrupulously to every treaty that we put our John Hancock to, I don't believe that for a second. So what are the odds that we are now doing this kind of experimentation under the name of something else?
Absolutely. I would say 100%.
100%. Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, and the reason I would say that is because when you read the treaty, and I reread the treaty in the last couple of months, there are so many holes in that treaty you could drive a truck through it. The fact is, all you have to do is make the assertion that it's for peaceful purposes, and largely you could escape the treaty guidelines. And it even speaks about ionospheric modification as a specific area within that treaty, and this is exactly the stuff of HAARP.
Have you lately seen maps of the world showing the ice shrinkage both at the North Pole and the South Pole?
Yes, I have. In fact, it's something that I followed for a number of years because in my region of the world, of course, we see the effects of it much more rapidly. You know, when this idea of global warming is amplified at the poles, the fact of the matter is, in my lifetime, I can take you to glaciers that once I could see from roads that now are so far back in the mountains you can't see them. You can look at pictures of glaciers 100 years ago versus today and see huge, huge differences. In the area of Valdez, they're almost 800 feet thinner than they were at the turn of the century when the last gold rush was going.
Well, you know, there are people who argue, perhaps with some merit, that these things are cyclic. Perhaps so, but when you look now at the North Pole, for example, and it looks like two-thirds of what once was ice and solid snow and ice or whatever was up there is gone now. Two-thirds of it are gone. And there will soon be a new ocean at the Arctic,
right.
One that we're now going to have to navigate for military purposes and learn to patrol and all the rest of it. I mean, things are changing so quickly from a weather point of view that one really might imagine they are, by gosh, they're trying something.
Well, I think there's a combination of factors. You know, I don't disagree with the natural cycles, because looking at the geologic record, you can see that. But now what you're doing is at a time when already you're seeing dramatic changes, we're adding in tremendous amounts of coherent, controlled energy to trigger further instabilities. That is a reckless approach from my perspective and many others around the planet today.
Well, we're short little mortal beings, Doctor. We're not here very long, and I always thought we're not supposed to see those kinds of changes within our short mortal life, that these changes should occur over tens or hundreds of thousands of years, not from 1985 through 1991 and that sort of thing. Those small periods, tiny periods of time from a geologic perspective, we're getting these giant changes.
That's right. And you know, and what I would say is we haven't seen anything yet. And I mean that sincerely, because
really?
I believe we're going to see an acceleration of these shifts in chaotic conditions, both from nature and from man's activities, particularly when man begins to utilize systems specifically designed to interfere with these natural processes. And that is what we're in the process of seeing happen.
20, 25 years ago, it was unthinkable that they'd call off the Iditarod race because it wouldn't be enough snow.
Right.
It was just unthinkable.
Well, and you know, we've got a problem in my part of the world. I mean, this year is the first year that's looked like winter in quite a while in my part of Alaska. And, you know, we've seen huge changes. And, you know, the last winter, we didn't even have snow till December 11th in South Central Alaska. You know, that is unheard of. You know, when I grew up in Alaska as a young kid, by October, we always had snow on the ground because we went out. You know, that was trick-or-treating, right? And it was always a mess because you had to fight the snow and the cold. Nowadays, it's not so much that way. In fact, we have a week on the front end and a week on the back end, more time in the summer than we used to have.
And do you know there's an Air Force website that boasts that by 20-something or another they'll own the weather?
Yes. Actually, we cite that that study in the book Earth Rising the Revolution, which we published in 2000.
Well, what do they mean they'll own the weather?
The idea is they want to control a number of specific factors. In fact, what they were talking about was controlling it for the battle space. In other words, if you could control the weather, think about that in terms of its implications. And one of the other considerations is controlling the weather. You could actually fight a war without ever declaring it or without ever being upfront about it. In other words, you could have a clandestine war that denied someone the benefits of a proper weather distribution, perhaps causing massive droughts such as what we see in North Korea today. You know, that kind of phenomena can be artificially created with the right technologies that are available today. When you look at of that particular owning the weather as a concept, there's a number of papers that speak to that, and you can go back into the early days of the discussion, which in the hearing before the Subcommittee on International Organizations, which was a committee on international relations in the House of Representatives on July 29, 1975, was a prohibition on weather modification as a weapon of war. It was a resolution, resolution number 28, passed at that time. And what they said, and this is interesting, is that if weather modification research is open and above board, if it is conducted domestically by domestic agencies, then a fairly high level of credibility can be established. If, on the other hand, weather modification research is conducted in secret, frequently outside the country by military or intelligence agencies, then I would suggest that any treaty would not be worth the paper it was printed on, unquote. And that was by a congressman in the committee in 75, and I would say he's right. It's not worth the paper it's printed on because weather doesn't respect international boundaries that are artificially drawn by mankind.
Well, or we could think of it this way. There's not really any point in making treaties against doing something that can't be done.
Right, and this is... Think how old that is, 1978. And you know when the dialogue started? Because it takes time, you know, to get to the finish line on these things.
Yes.
It was 72 when the conversations first began. That's how far back this technology goes. And it wasn't just about weather. It was environmental manipulation. They were considering things within that treaty such as stimulation of earthquakes or volcanic eruptions or tidal waves, those kind of geophysical phenomena that didn't come back around until April 1997 when Secretary of Defense William Cohen was lecturing with Senators Lugar and Nunn at a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and U.S. strategy. That was April 28, 1997. And he said in the press briefing afterwards, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Think about that from a seated Secretary of Defense at the time making that assertion about terrorist states.
Well, all of this sounds really Tesla-like to me.
You know, it's interesting because when you go back to Dr. Eastland's original work, you know, he actually references a number of articles from Tesla's early experiments going back even to 1915 and then his later ideas in the early 40s just before his death. And, you know, Tesla, you know, had this concept, and when you really look at all of his patents, they were about oscillating energy, about modulating energy
in
specific ways to create resonance effects. And resonance effects are easily understood if you think about dialing through the radio station as people did tonight to get into this program. In between the stations is just static, but when you have resonance between the transmitter and the receiver, you have a nice clear signal. The same is true in the human body. The same is true in the earth. The same is true in every physical thing. You can create resonance effects that have devastating capability.
Were there not rumors that Tesla at some point had shaken a building, had caused an earthquake, all kinds of interesting rumors in that area about Tesla?
Yeah, actually it was based on a technology that he had developed. That rumor was based on an experiment in New York City in 1898 where he took a small oscillator, attached it to an I-beam in an office building.
That was it.
And then that I-beam that was, you know, then deep into the earth, it was just a small oscillator that created an oscillation in harmony with the earth at that particular point, causing that resonance effect, and it supposedly broke glass for several, you know, in buildings surrounding this event. Now, I never saw anything that confirms that. I keep seeing it in the literature, but this, again, is the kind of thing that speaks to exactly what Secretary of Defense Cohen was saying 100 years later.
Exactly.
And here we are revisiting the same game all over again, and we're saying that it's so simple that even a terrorist can figure it out. That is a telling tale when you think about what is possible today. And when you look at these kinds of weapon systems being developed, they also all create a very clear signal. Anyone who's experimenting this area would understand what the dynamics of those signals are, and those can be easily monitored by satellite-based technology. So we probably have a pretty good idea of where these technologies are being tested and played with. And yet, you know, we're the biggest player probably on the block, so we're not saying a whole lot.
Well, we went in and confiscated all of Tesla's research and all of his materials and everything, and frankly, a lot of what we're doing right now sounds like it's the same rough idea. In other words, tickling the tail of the tiger, you know, for the giant effect, whether it's HARP or whether it's research into weather control or weapons that would act as a shield for the whole country. Right. All of this sounds like it's tickling the tiger's tail, doesn't it?
And in fact, I think it really is. I think when you look at this whole situation, it's the technologies have now caught up in many respects to what Tesla had envisioned, because many of the ideas he had, you know, he would actually have to create all of the things that were necessary to make it happen.
Hold on, Doctor. We're here at the bottom of the hour. I understand I literally gave them a heart attack at ABC in New York when I did this a little while ago. Well, I really like this song, you know? It's really cool. I ought to make it my theme song. Just kidding, folks! Actually, this is sort of a repayment kind of thing. Some of you will understand. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
When you tickle the tiger's tail in the old days, didn't mean too much. Well, it, you know, could have personal implications for you. Something could happen to you. But now we're tickling the tail of a global tiger. And if that tiger decides to turn around, put out the claws, and rake across the tickler, that would be all of us, you see. So that people understand what we're talking about here by, you know, tickling the tiger's tail. Doctor, was I right? I mean, in the old days, you could do scientific experiments that perhaps would have some sort of local effect. Possibly a negative effect or a positive effect, who knows, but local. These days, we're beginning to experiment with tickling the tail of the tiger, of the global tiger.
Absolutely, and HARP is not the only example of it. There are several systems being developed and that have created some level of controversy that are essentially doing the same thing in different areas. The underwater sonars are a good example of, you know, of what's happening in the seas in the same vein as, you know, when you're looking at these kinds of systems, they're not like of the past, where we looked at, you know, doing these events that were localized. I mean, we could, you know, using ordnance, bombs, and bullets, you know, certain things happened, but they didn't have global implications in the manner in which they do now. Now we're talking about deliberately manipulating a normal environmental systems as if they were a component to plug into a machine on the ground. That is the difference.
Yeah, and the other thing is that science has had a habit, always, actually, of sort of, it's not quite this bad, but, gee, let's push this button and see what happens. You know? And so there is some of that, because a lot of times they honestly, and they will even tell you, they don't know what's going to happen when they push that button. Not exactly. Certainly we all know when they tested the A-bomb, there was a significant percentage of people who thought it would set off a chain reaction in the atmosphere and burn up the whole damn atmosphere.
Right. In fact, you know, the scientists, a part of the way our science is developed in the United States, we compartmentalize most of our military research. And what that means is we separate all of the various specialties in the sciences, and they each kind of work on their own little piece of the puzzle.
Sure.
And only a few people know how the puzzle goes together at the top. So one group of specialists doesn't really understand necessarily the implications of their science for other areas of science. So, you know, often they'll say, yeah, you know, but I never heard about that. I mean, I hear that from scientists all the time. Well, I never heard about that, as if they had heard everything that ever was uttered on the planet.
That's right. All right. Now, very quickly, with regard again to HAARP, HAARP is now owned by a company that has something to do with DARPA. What's DARPA?
DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Is that what it is? Okay.
And that's who they are. And actually, you know, they are the ones that have the funding for the next couple of years to take this array to the next step.
Ah, so DARPA's funding the new money, huh?
That's where the new money is. Now, DARPA didn't miss HAARP along the way. Back in 1997, they had actually published a little blip about HAARP in a topic number DARPA 97-088. Where they talk about using HAARP and HIPAS, which is the other facility located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, specifically for subsurface monitoring, for looking at what's under the ground.
Mm.
So DARPA's had an interest in HAARP, but this is the first time that we've seen them take control of the funding, which means, you know, those who control the gold control the destiny, you know, in terms of how this project is going to go.
Yes.
So with DARPA engaged, and this idea of earth-penetrating tomography going back to 1997, one of their principal issues, you can still see the merit of that. I mean, today, look at the situation in Iraq. If we could get full imaging under the ground, wouldn't that be useful? Which is exactly what John Heckscher said to us in 1994 when we were researching this subject in the early days. He said, wouldn't this be great? Because it was in the aftermath of the first Gulf War. Well, here we are a decade later asking the same question.
Doctor, do you get people coming to you who know what's going on in the inside right now? I mean, frankly, they could be so far along, we don't even have a clue how far along they are. Do you ever have people, you know, sort of, I'll tell you type guys come to you and tell you what's going on?
I've had only a couple of occasions, and generally I won't reference those sources because I won't reference an anonymous source.
Of course.
And to me, that's just not a valid way. However, there have been occasions where we've been pointed in some directions to go look, to go ask for the right things.
Yes.
That they have to give us because they're public records. So in that sense, yes, there's also a couple of people that we've been communicating with recently that are compiling some things from the inside of this program that are non-classified materials. Because we will not touch anything that's classified. It's just, we don't need it, we don't want to go there, and I don't want to go to jail, quite
frankly.
Well,
you're always getting close to it.
Oh, yeah, we're on the edge.
Have you ever been offered?
Yes, and we've declined.
And you've declined.
Yep, and we've declined because we don't know whether we're being set up for the fall.
Yes.
Or whether it's something that we really need. And our position on it is, as long as the national security rules are as they are, we'll respect the law, and our position is the law ought to be changed. And when that law changes and we have the ability to at least conceptually debate these issues and that those issues and concepts become disclosed, then it would be another matter. But our view is we may not agree with the way it works, but we'll respect the law as it currently stands and work with the public literature.
Fair enough. All right, a couple of other things I want to touch on. You've written something about China And, you know, China is going to the moon. They say they're going to the moon. And it's a curious thing indeed because, of course, we've been to the moon. And from what I was told, nothing but a bunch of rocks and no real reason to go there. And yet, as a matter of fact, I understand our own president may be about to announce as early as Monday, it could happen, that we're going back to the moon. He's going to go back to the moon with a shuttle. China's announced they're going to the moon. What's going on here?
Well, it's not really so much about the moon as it is about developing technologies for what are considered would be used as low orbiting space platforms. And the idea is to gain enough knowledge so that we can put in space platforms that could maintain relatively low orbits. We have figured out ways to stabilize satellites now.
Well, how does going to the moon help that?
Well, because you got to have the basic technology. I mean, you have to be able, and at the same time, when you're developing, China to go out to the world and announce, hey, we're going to develop space-based platforms, that's not going to be a very popular concept.
Probably not.
On the other hand, a trip to the moon doesn't really bother everybody as much as military applications,
oh.
But ultimately they result in the same basic knowledge. How to develop the technology. Remember the, part of this was going back, I think, to the tether experiment. Do you remember that one?
Clearly.
Okay. You know, one of the big problems with maintaining low orbits is the power source. And one of the things with HARP early on was that you could actually concentrate the energy in such a way that it could be converted then by space platforms orbiting at low orbits, so you could keep it aloft for an indefinite period of time without refueling. The tether experiment, in my opinion, was not just about sticking something down there to drag through the ionosphere. It was about sucking energy off the ionosphere by moving through that area.
Yes.
And the energy that they conducted off of it was significantly more than anybody expected. It almost destroyed the shuttle, as many will recall.
It sure did. It burned the hell out of that tether, just like that.
Yep. But take that concept now and consider the fact that if you could draw that energy off in a controlled way, now you're talking about some serious
energy.
Serious energy.
You know, this is perhaps related or unrelated. Actually, I think it's related, Doctor. As a ham operator, I now have up this incredible antenna. I put up this two-wire, 1,000-foot loop. And I put a grounding system all the way under it, you know, a welded wire mesh wire, 4 feet wide all the way under it, and the loop itself's up at fed at 100 feet, and then at 75 feet and 68 feet all the way around an acre and a quarter I have here. And I began getting almost 400 volts on a clear, cloudless, windless day off that antenna, so bad that I had to come up with a device to ground the voltage so that it wouldn't damage my equipment. Now, where the hell was that coming from? It had AC and DC components to it. I'm going to experiment more with it. As a matter of fact,
energy.
By the way, Doctor, I just acquired some property, and I'm going to double the size of my loop. It's going to be going soon around 5 acres in another month or so. Big project ahead. But I'm telling you, my friend, there's power coming from somewhere.
Well, you know, there's a good friend of mine did an experiment where he took, and he didn't explain exactly what kind of coils he used, but he took the conductive copper wire and ran it from about a 1,000-foot elevation down to about a 500-foot elevation.
Yes.
And put coils in, and he actually picked up usable energy off of that simple system.
Absolutely.
You know, from apparently nowhere. Now, the energy is obviously being produced naturally by the Earth or by the Sun or some interaction between all of that, and it's being able to be drawn off. I think that's really the essence of some of this, at least one version of a free energy device.
Tesla was all after, right?
Right. That's right. And it's a case of sometimes, you know, these things happen purely by accident. You're trying for one thing and something quite different occurs, and that is probably what you're experiencing. I mean, 400 volts, that's a lot of
On my butt a few times, and I worried for my equipment. That was the number one thing, so I actually put a device in there that took all that voltage to ground. Granted, not a whole lot of current, but enough current, and it really hit me hard, shocked me a bunch of times before I finally learned that power is coming from somewhere. You might suspect some coupling from, power lines going by, that sort of thing. But we've got very relatively low power lines. A lot of them are underground here. and even the ones that are in the air are very low voltage comparatively, you know, very rural power lines.
Right.
Very unlikely that this kind of voltage would develop. So, and then I called the power company because I was so curious, doctor, and I said, look, you guys have zillions of lines in the air. We have a local electric cooperative here, and you must have a bunch of long lines that are unterminated or not being used. I want to ask you, do you measure large voltages at the end of these lines? And the response was, well, no, because by code, any unused line has got to be terminated to ground. That's a regulation. So they know and routinely accept the fact that they get this incredible power on these lines that's coming from wherever.
Yeah.
And they just ground it. They don't want anything to do with it. They just sort of ignore it and ground it. So he had nothing to say on the subject other than that, oh, yeah, sure, we ground it.
Well, you know, when you have intense solar activity, it can actually send a charge through power lines.
Granted, yep.
That can then blow out transformers. In fact, if you go back to the early Woodpecker signal from the former Soviet Union that we were talking about, you know, there was a power failure in Quebec around the time that that was occurring.
Totally. I understand all that, but I'm telling you, doctor, this is separate and apart from that.
Huh. It's interesting. I mean, I think this is, again, it goes back to, you know, some of those things that, again, we're not clear on what the cause and effect relationships are, but think about that in the context of the kindergarten with the hand grenade, and that's the equivalent of our scientists. You know, we hope they don't pull the pin, but there's a lot of folks that are very excited about their area of science and are willing to take risks and take and expose the rest of us to those risks without much consideration. I think
here we go. So we know science is doing this, and we know that they're way out there somewhere, but how do you get oversight on a project that is, by its very nature, so secret it's probably violating treaties? How do you get oversight on something like that? Because the answer has to be, oh, we're not doing that.
Well, and that's been the standard story. They've gotten caught a few times along the way, so they've been a little bit less willing to talk to media because they've gotten caught in their own trap. The other thing that's happening now, and the effort that we put forward, was predominantly to let European parliamentarians, our traditional allies, know what was happening here on this project. And as they got involved, you know, the European Parliament did finally take an action. That was the beginning step. You know, after that, there was a major study done by STOA, which is a group within the European Parliament that does technical and scientific research for the Parliament. And they analyzed all the literature dealing with everything from the electromagnetic effects of toaster ovens all the way to these large weapon systems. And their conclusions were that there were significant risks. Now, since that study has been completed, I'm not sure how much progress they have made. Our guys that we worked most closely with in the European Parliament are no longer in that position where they can help us there. But we did see the resolution passed. The Russians acting recently, that group of Russian parliamentarians that acted actually heard one of my presentations in 1997 in Brussels when I was speaking to a group called GLOBE, which represents legislators from 40 countries dealing with primarily environmental issues. And at that conference, there were 12 members of the Russian Duma that heard my presentation, which was dealing with Arctic issues, and my section dealt with HAARP. That is what started their look at it. And what took so long was their scientists were reluctant to come forward. But once they came forward and explained how these technologies worked and the fact that they could work, that's when that resolution finally passed. Now, the effect of it, we have not seen much. I mean, we see it now starting to surface in some of the discussions around the world. So obviously people have taken notice in other legislatures or parliaments within Europe. And I think that's ultimately the only way that accountability will be forced.
Back for a second to the tether. Now, the tether was a real scientific surprise. Now, I have not seen nor read any follow-up to the tether experiment. Obviously, science had to be so shocked, pardon the pun, with that result, that you would think that there would be immediate proposals for experiments to find out what they really encountered when they let that thing loose, how much they really encountered, because certainly they couldn't measure it. They could make guesses, but they couldn't measure it. They couldn't know how sustained it was. It could be something very important for humanity as a power source. I mean, I'm sort of fishing around here, but in other words, where is the follow-up?
And again, you know, what often happens with many programs is a certain amount of the program is public because it's unavoidable. In that case, people could see it from the ground, right?
Yeah, well, sure.
So you had to have some plausible explanation for what you're doing. And maybe the intention was exactly that, was to draw energy off in a way that could be useful.
Well, in that case, they got a hell of a result. So where is the follow-up? Are they going to do another experiment? Did anybody ask NASA? Well, okay then. With regard to the tether, what next?
Well, and I think the nature of these things are, once something is discovered that is unexpected and might be useful, these things tend to go black. I mean, if a power supply were realized in the ionosphere, it would not be to the United States' advantage to announce that.
You mean black from an intelligence point of view?
From an intelligence perspective, yes. I'm sorry. But basically just taking it out of the public view. What if every country knew that there was this unlimited power supply available for space platforms? They would quit worrying about that particular technical aspect of space platforms, which is the most important aspect, incidentally. So it would make sense if they discovered that to just be totally quiet about its implications. And I think, though, anyone watching that with any science background would look at it and say, wait a minute, where did that energy come from? How much energy was there, and what can we do with it? Which is exactly what I believe our government is, in fact, doing. As we move forward to space-based platforms, think of this concept of preemptive warfare, the idea that you can wipe out your adversaries before you let them know that they're an adversary. This is a pretty interesting thought, because what if the Chinese make the breakthroughs first? Or what if the Russians go back and make breakthroughs in this area, or some other rogue state, as they're calling them now? Then who can really get to the technology the quickest is going to be the victor. That is a very dangerous thing. Speed of light weapons and preemptive war do not mix.
Well, Doctor, we can't let treaties get in the way of something that profoundly important to our very survival. Now, can we?
Well, unfortunately, you know, that's the mindset that too many people are taking. Then why bother with the treaties in the first place if we're not going to honor them? The fact of the matter is, we have to find some way to find some compatibility with our science, with the advancements and the risks the world takes. And it doesn't include excluding our traditional allies, which we have been doing. And we've been doing it since 1998 and 99, when we first started talking about this issue of the ABM treaty, as an example. And nobody, none of the parliamentarians in Europe could imagine the U.S. doing this without at least cluing them in.
All right.
And we keep doing it. We've been doing it.
All right. Hold tight, Doctor. We're at the top of the hour. When we get back, we'll try and open phone lines, let all of you ask questions. And I bet about all of this, you have questions, don't you? From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast, AM in the nighttime.
Everything's
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Electronic swords cutting through the night. Yeah. Electromagnetic swords slashing across cities and entire areas. Possible? Yes, it is. Are we working on it right now? Well, we've probably been working on it for a long time. Do we have it right now? Well, that's another question, isn't it? We'll be right back. If you have a question for Dr. Begich, those were the numbers, and we're, I think, ready for you now. All right, we're looking now, of course, from all of you out there, for questions that are relevant to what Dr. Begich has been discussing this morning, and we're about to go to the phones. But Dr. Begich, very quickly, well, actually a couple things. One is, the sonars the Navy is using, is there any chance that these sonars are causing whales to commit suicide, beach themselves?
Absolutely. In fact, the Navy acknowledged it recently, and they actually settled a lawsuit. There's some holes in that settlement. The Navy actually looked at the beaching in the Bahamas. It was a multi-species beaching that occurred a couple years back. And on the beach where these whales came ashore was a scientist from Harvard University that was able to take the animals and actually have them analyzed at Harvard. And they determined that what had happened was a massive trauma. And the reason this happened is when sound travels in the air, for instance, 99.97% of the energy in that sound is bounced off or reflected away from tissue. In water, in salt water, it acts much differently. The sound, when it travels through salt water and strikes tissue, 100% of the energy is absorbed into that tissue until it hits a air cavity like lungs or nasal passages that exist in marine mammals. When the energy is released, it causes a massive hemorrhaging, which is what leads them to beach themselves. The same thing could happen to humans in the water where these sonars are actually.
So then you're telling me that the Navy in this lawsuit essentially acknowledged that what the sonar they used did that?
Yes. In fact, what they agreed to do in settling the case is they agreed to not use the sonars in any waters except in certain parts of Asia, which I think is interesting. And then the other area that they said that they would continue to use them is in wartime, and I kind of wonder what time it is now, because I keep hearing that we're in a war and that we're in the war zone as far as that goes. But the last thing that happened, the most recent thing that's happened, is if you look at the defense budget or the budget that came out of the House, and I don't know whether it stayed in the Senate. I've got to check it when I get an opportunity to do it, but they had put in an exemption to exempt the military from all environmental standards. The environmental laws that control what happens in private industry applies to military also at the present time. They want to get themselves exempted out of this. This has come up periodically, but apparently made it in the House version of the budget as a writer. If this happens, then the agreement that the Navy has just made with the litigants in California and Hawaii will essentially be moot. If they change the rules, then that lawsuit won't have any meaning whatsoever. And yet what's at risk is not just whales. It's all the life in the sea. In fact, we dedicated about 60 pages to this topic in our latest book, Earth Rising 2, which really gets into the meat of what's happening with the sonar. So it's not a dead issue. Just because this lawsuit is settled does not mean the story is over. In fact, we expect that this is going to be back to visit us in the not-too-distant future.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to let you do, was plug your book, and you sort of did that. But that's the latest, Earth Rising 2?
Earth Rising 2, the one that precedes it is Earth Rising, the Revolution, and those are available through Earth Pulse and also on Amazon.com, which we're linked up to through you guys tonight. And you can also get them toll-free from us, and that's at 888 690 1277.
A couple of weeks ago, two weeks ago now, I was interviewing Bob Lazar. And Bob Lazar is sort of a guy who told about Area 51 and S4 and allegedly saw saucers and all that sort of thing. And I just asked him, I said, you know, asking him was my downfall. I asked the audience, look, if there's more Bob Lazars out there, come forward, send me an email, call me, whatever. And I made the mistake then of asking Bob Lazar if he thought that it would be a good idea for people like himself to come forward and tell what they knew. And he said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But, I mean, there must be lots of people who know about experiments and science going on in the areas that we're talking about right now that do have information, and I guess you don't want them to come forward to you either.
Not necessarily. And, you know, what I had suggested to Tom Spencer, who was a chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, and it was to be his next initiative, was I had suggested a mechanism for a whistleblowing, to where you could come forward, but in an environment where, where national secrets wouldn't necessarily be disclosed, but where people either in the civilian sector or government sectors of the various countries of the world had information that it was in our interest as the human race to have that information, which might actually violate some specific country's national code. But if the human race was at risk, that the human race had an opportunity to weigh in. So a whistleblower mechanism, I think, is still needed, but it needs to be done in a manner that is sensible, is rational, and I think that needs some thinking to develop.
But to get them to agree to some sort of amnesty here would be almost impossible. I suppose it could be pushed through and hopefully enforced, but...
Well, think about what happened in fact, we use this as an example, what happened in South Africa. After all of the horror, they did have an amnesty. You could come forward, you could acknowledge what happened, and if you didn't come forward and you got caught, you got your butt nailed. And I think those are the same kinds of things that could happen, is allow an opportunity for people to come forward in the public interest and make their statements in a way that does not jeopardize security, but at the same time...
That's tough. I mean, almost all of it is going to be under the blanket of national security, almost all of it.
But it's gotten too much. I mean, the fact of building this stuff, I agree. Building the equipment you don't want out there. But the concepts, the basic idea of say, ionospheric modification as an example, or triggering an earthquake as an example, those basic concepts, those ought to be open for some discussion. The fact is... they are discussed periodically. If there's research going on that is violating an international treaty, there needs to be some way for someone to come forward and say, hey, wait a minute, this is fundamentally wrong. The countries that are doing this have agreed not to, and yet here they are playing this game. There needs to be a way to do this. I think we shouldn't have to wait until people hit their 80s, and then we question their memories and everything else when they come forward, as we see in so many other controversial areas. People do want to clear their conscience, and there needs to be a manner and a mechanism to do that.
Well, you're right about people being in their 80s. I mean, by then, of course, your conscience goes to work on you. You don't have as much to lose, and so that's what we end up getting, people in their 80s. All right, let's try the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich in Alaska. Hello.
Thank you very much, Art Bell, and thank you, Dr. Begich, for your work. I commend your work, and I appreciate the credentials that go with it.
Where are you, sir?
I'm near Austin, Minnesota, but the radio signal's coming out of Mason City, Iowa.
All righty. Any question?
Yes. Regarding weather modification especially, and the upper atmosphere heating, is it not possible to lose or remove atmospheric moisture, that is to say, blow it right out of our atmosphere, utilizing something like HARP?
Well, I mean, if you create that heating effect, obviously it's going to, whatever's in that space underneath it is going to move to fill that empty space. And so, in that sense, it is removing moisture. But what happens when you shut it down? Eventually it comes back down and gets redistributed, but jet streams are what gets altered. And if you look at the weather maps and you look at what happens when jet streams do alter, dramatic changes in weather occur. You get lousy weather in the southeast, where you start to get snowfall where you shouldn't. You start
That's right.
to get freezing of crops and so on.
That's right.
And so these kinds of changes, when they occur, jet stream effects not only affect weather fronts, but they also affect the flow of moisture and cloud formations in terms of where they go and where they're going to end up in delivering that rain. So if the jet streams get altered and that moisture gets moved into another area where it's maybe not needed or is just unusual, like in the desert areas versus in the places where you're trying to grow crops, then you've got huge problems. When you have lots of countries experimenting in this way, you can get very unpredictable results. So it's like the butterfly effect, where the flapping of the wings of a butterfly was the analysis, can cause huge storms on the other side of the planet. And this was discovered when a scientist had made a very slight calculation error, but the ramifications of that error were huge. And this led into this whole area of chaos theory and the idea of small amounts of energy being able to create profound and unexpected results. And that's the essence of much of what we've been talking about tonight. Only the thing that's happening is they're not so unexpected anymore. Yeah. Now we're gaining an understanding on how to control them and make them happen at will.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Begich. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell. Hey, may I suggest a future guest and also pose a question to Dr. Begich?
Yes.
Pat Robertson.
Okay.
This is Blair in Sedona. Dr. Begich, my urge to impel you to run for political office is tempered by my skepticism of electronic voting technology in a democratic republic. Would you comment?
Well, you know, that is a really important issue. And, you know, I believe in paper ballots. I don't believe in there are some things that don't belong in terms of automation. And I think voting is the single biggest issue in the country. And
you
I think
you made a public statement about this, haven't you? Voting machines, something about that?
Well, I just oppose them. I oppose them vigorously. I think that we need to stick to things that we can count at the end of the day. My brother just won the mayor of Anchorage here not too long ago, and he won by 18 votes.
18 votes.
And they used an AccuCount system, but fortunately there's also a ballot that goes with it, and they had to recount them. And in recounting them, the difference was one vote. So in this case, AccuVote was accurate, but only because there was a hard copy ballot that was behind it that could also be counted.
So let there be chads.
Well, you know, I think maybe we got to go back to ink, you know, so we don't have to worry about things hanging off. I mean, you're going to either put the X in the right box or it's not going to be there.
All right, easy east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Dr. Begich. Hello.
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 Yes, thank you, Mr. Bell, for being there and making the world a heck of a lot better place to be in.
You're very welcome.
Esoterically speaking, I caught your message, and I think a few others did too. And when they steal works of art, bells, why, that's nothing more than the sheerest form of flattery. So whip it back on him. And two questions for your guest.
Yes.
Did you know that the state police of Alaska are paramilitary trained now? And two, did you know that Ted Stevens, he must be something up there with them, because Alaska got the lion's share, hands down, of all the pork that went into this latest spending bill.
Yeah, a couple of good points there.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's not just Alaska, but most police forces around the country are moving in this direction. The Europeans actually are resisting it, calling the FBI corrupt in public reports and not accepting any of their recommendations in this regard. As far as, you know, sort of where it all goes, you know, militarization of police is a much different direction than policing generally has been in the past. As far as Stevens go, he is the chairman of appropriations. He is running the checkbook for the United States. And you are absolutely right. Per capita, Alaskans receive more federal dollars than anyone else in the country. And it is by virtue of the fact that Ted Stevens is there and controls that checkbook. And he's a very intimidating figure for people. I mean, people do not openly resist him for very long in the Senate, and you've seen that occasionally when his temper breaks out. He has made some public statements in Alaska regarding indigenous people in our state that is pretty backwards, talking about the indigenous population growing too fast and jeopardizing the present state of politics in Alaska. And those are statements that 10 years ago would have been considered totally unacceptable in the middle of the civil rights movement. And going today, you know, people objected very strongly, and the people that objected the strongest are out of their jobs. And the fact is, this guy and other people like him have tremendous power that they can wield, and they do wield it to benefit their state from their perspective. A lot of the pork that gets put into the program isn't even asked for by citizens within Alaska. It's just something he decides he wants to do, and he does it because he has the ability to do so.
Well, gee, maybe he could get together with a very famous person there in West Virginia and propose building a road between Anchorage and, I don't know, Charleston.
Well, you know, they're
probably get built.
They're getting together on a lot of projects these days, and the thing about it is it's a lot of it is quite good. I mean, to be fair, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen within the political matrix that get pretty upsetting to me, and I think a lot of it, in terms of military spending, the kinds of things that we're seeing happen now, you know, we're spending $87 billion to rebuild Iraq when we know by national reports that if we put that same money into the first peoples of this country, the indigenous, we could completely solve many of the big problems that have been plaguing indigenous people here for 200 years.
Well, that's a lot of money. I mean, I'd do a lot of things, $87 billion. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I very much respect and admire Nick Begich. I'm very grateful for what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Okay, I'm feeling a little nervous now because I know we're getting to the bottom of the hour, and I hope I have
sorry,
a chance
to. Just go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think the bottom line in all of this is life on the planet and, of course, the environment that supports life. And I think that it's just as important to be concerned about individual people who are being affected by this as the big picture. Both count. And I would really like to ask you what your opinion is as to what the Defense Department or its contractors are looking for when they are sending electromagnetic pulse radiation, supposedly, quote, non-lethal, unquote, weaponry, at unwitting guinea pigs, and what they are, testing them for. And in many cases, biochips have been planted in these people unbeknownst to them.
All right, well, hold it right there. When they test, and I guess they, you know, there's a long history, which you alluded to earlier, Doctor, of the U.S. government spraying people in the Bay Area, of the U.S. government conducting biological experiments that will raise the hair on the back of your neck. So they've done this stuff. The nuclear things with the pregnant women, oh, God, it goes on and on. So if you extend that to imagine they're still doing it today, then they probably are exposing people to radiation of various sorts to find things out.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. In fact, probably the most difficult material that we ever researched was on the U.S. government's experimentation on our own citizenry. And Secretary of Energy O'Leary admitted to 500,000 Americans over 40 years being experimented on without their consent, and yet not one person ever went to court, and no one was ever put in jail for doing that. The same things in Nazi Germany caused people to swing by their necks at the end of the war.
How come there weren't, like, after she said that, like, big congressional investigative hearings into this sort of thing with some kind of result at the other end? You're right. I mean, she just came out and said it, and
one did a thing.
Everybody was shocked. It ran on the evening news. Everybody went, wow! And that was it.
And that was it. We never even got to find out who the 500,000 people were that they admit to, so they might be able to at least have some relief in their life. The fact is experimentation, I think, does go on. They try and get what they call informed consent, and every once in a while they get caught because they didn't inform people quite right. So this does go on, but the places where technologies get tested are in the battle environments. I mean, right now in Iraq, I'm sure that we're trying every technical technology that we have available to us in order to see how they work. In terms of individual people in the United States being victimized by these kinds of systems, I hear from probably 3 to 4 people every week that make that assertion.
I bet you do.
And I believe several of them are probably exactly what is.
Well, if history is any teacher, then yes, doctor. Hold on, we're at the bottom of the hour. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest, and you should be listening very carefully because all of this is going on right now. You really don't know. All right, now, listen very carefully. If you have questions for Dr. Begich, here is your conduit.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It's really something to think about, isn't it? That they could be affecting our entire environment with scientific experiments and even weapons that we don't even begin to understand, but maybe Tesla did. From the high desert, coast to coast, underway once again with Dr. Nick Begich in a moment. You know, if you can affect people's behavior, then here's a really good question for, kind of a politician. Dr. Begich, do you suppose that something like HAARP, if sufficiently developed, could be used to influence the outcome of a national election?
Great question. In fact, if you go back to a book called Between Two Ages, written by Zbigniew Brzezinski in the early 1970s when he was at Columbia University, before he became National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, in that book, I think it's around page 55 or 56, you'll see a quote, which is a quote from J.F. Gordon MacDonald about electronically stroking the ionosphere to modify the behavior of people over large geographic areas.
Yes.
And then you'll see later in the text, because the whole text is about the technological implications and how they might be used. And what he says is that no matter who's in power, the temptation to utilize these technologies to further their political ends, whether conservative or liberal, would probably be used because of people's lack of good judgment. And essentially what he was saying was that he really believed that as these technologies emerged, that politicians, if they could do it, would be tempted to try it. And if you remember on a more overt basis, the last presidential election, you remember the word rats inserted into some advertising of Bush against Democrats?
I heard that. Yeah.
And it was a little bit of a subliminal, and he pulled the ad and everything. He said, oh, it wasn't subliminal. We weren't meaning anything by that. These are very powerful techniques. In fact, if you utilize even light sequencing, if you look, like when you're watching a television set in the dark, if you turn around and look at the white wall behind you, you can actually see the flicker rate. And usually it's incoherent. There's no real pattern there. But if people really understood, and there are people that do very much understand, that you can create a very highly suggestive state by having a flicker rate in the background of a broadcast, those things are not regulated by any law. And you can put someone in a highly suggestive state as they're watching that commercial and actually influence them in a much more profound way than a standard advertisement. There are no regulations, ladies and gentlemen, on this, and yet the technology has been well proven.
Okay, here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Good morning.
Good morning. It's so good to talk to you, Art, and also thank you very much for having Dr. Begich on. He's very knowledgeable, and
indeed,
these points that are being raised are points that need to be raised. I wish this were in the daytime where more people would be hearing it. Anyway, going back to the question of the tether. Oh, this is Joan calling from Cleveland.
Okay.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes.
And it's WTAM 1100.
You bet.
Anyway, there's an electric field that extends out from the Earth, as I'm sure Dr. Begich knows. Am I pronouncing the name right?
It's Begich, actually.
Begich.
Okay. Thank you. And it's about 150 volts per meter. So if you go far enough out, I don't know how long the tether was, but as it cut through, it would seem to me that that would be the source of the energy. Remember, you were talking about that earlier?
The ionosphere is fed from essentially the energy of the sun striking the magnetosphere, and the interaction of solar energy and the magnetic field lines create that energy that's there. And so the energy that's there is huge. I mean, it's well acknowledged that there's tremendous energy potentials available in the ionosphere. The problem has always been, at least, you know, this, well, not even a problem, just a question has been raised, can you tap it? And that was where HAARP began, with Senator Stevens again saying, hey, we've got this thing right out of Jules Verne. Mm-hmm. We can tap the energy of the Aurora Electrojet and fuel the planet. And at the same time, you've got, a few years later, a tether experiment where they're actually trying to tap that energy, and they get the surprise of their lives when they find out there's a heck of a lot more happening there than they even anticipated. And this is, again, why it's so important to not move too fast in these areas. Here they are having unexpected results almost every time they enter into these experiments. And if you don't have an expectation that is lining up with the experiment, you need to pull back a little bit and recognize that maybe we're missing a few chapters of the book before we get to the final one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened. It's, again, you know, I don't criticize scientists for being enthusiastic about their fields, because everybody is. The question is exercising caution when the amount of impact we can have now has global implications, not just local implications.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question.
Yes.
Take care.
Bye now.
All right. You're very welcome. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Good morning.
I guess I'm the wild card dude.
That's you. You're the dude.
Okie dokie.
Where are you calling from, dude?
I'm calling from Houston, Texas.
All right. Speak up good and loud like you're a Texan so we can
all
hear
righty.
You. That's it. Get right up on that phone and kiss it.
No problem.
That's the way to do it. All right. So what's up?
Well, your previous caller brings up all types of questions in my mind, but I'll stick to the main question I had for you guys, you and Mr. Begich. Good evening, gentlemen. And I've heard about this kind of thing in the past where people have seen, like, strobes in atmosphere on clear nights or light blasts.
Yes.
And I've seen this several times in the last 5 years, and I always reason it out and rationalize it out of my mind, you know. And these are on perfectly clear nights where there's hardly no clouds in the sky for many, many, many miles across Texas. I see these, like, almost like an ambient, you know, it's not like seeing a flash, not like looking directly at a camera flash bulb. But it would be like you'd be seeing the ambient light cast from it. But it's really quick, really fast, just like a flash. And I can't explain it.
Well, maybe one explanation certainly might be that we are testing something. And I'm sure the wide open lands of Texas would be one possibility of a place to test such thing. I don't know. That's just a...
It's tough to put labels on some of this. You know, we can look at the record and we can say, okay, here's a patent that would give you that same visual effect, which is what we were mentioning quite a while ago in this program this evening. You know, but again, to draw those clean conclusions, you can make the observations, but again, you've got to be a little slow to leap to conclusions about what you're seeing, because it could be lots of different explanations.
Well, you know, just as a point of interest, a couple of days ago, there was a release that scientists just found out that aurora is occurring many hundreds of miles above the Earth's atmosphere. They had they were seeing this from the shuttle, and they're going, what the hell? And it turns out it's some kind of aurora that's occurring way beyond where we thought aurora could possibly occur.
Right.
Very interesting stuff. We don't understand an awful lot of the dynamics of the Earth's energy and how it interacts with the sun, do we?
Do you remember the sprites that they were seeing on the top of storm clouds?
Of course, yes, of course.
That reached up into the ionosphere?
Surprise, surprise, yes.
And again, another surprise, not calculated in any of the calculations to make the global model, and yet here we are running around with experiments that are exploiting instabilities, that are creating instabilities, without full knowledge of what we're doing. And I think this is where this has to be broader. It has to involve the international community. It cannot be done under the cloak of darkness for military applications. Too much is at stake. There are too many risks involved, and we can't allow one country, even if it is our own, to run in this direction without some oversight. I just think we're entering into a realm that we've been in for some time now that is headed down a path that we may not easily recapture.
The moment you begin to spotlight the subject in terms of having international controls, then you immediately advertise the fact that, baby, you're doing it, or you can do it, or you've done it, or something.
That's right.
So I don't know how you do one without, you know, bringing the other to the surface. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Steve from Arkansas.
Yes, sir.
With you talking about HARP and climate control, one thing that just shoots out in my mind is earlier this year we had our government butted heads with the French, and the French have had a really bad year, and it kind of culminated this August with a massive heat wave there that resulted in, I think they last count, 15,000 dead in France.
Right.
Alone.
Right.
This just jumps out at me.
Well, you know, I was just in Europe in late October and early November lecturing in Lucerne, and the question came up from folks in Europe, could it be that some of our experiments are creating these effects? And the answer is yes, it could be. Is it? There's another question. The fact is there are many governments that are playing the game of weather modification on some level. How these things chain react around the planet are unpredictable. And then when you add in what nature is already doing, it's the straw on the camel's back, as I've said many times before. And it could be us, it could be someone else, or it could be nature exercising its own changes. But the fact is these things are occurring. When you look at, you know, some areas are warming up, some areas are cooling off. There's reasons for that mechanically. But the basic message is things are radically different. Look at the amount of intensity of these storms in just the beginning of this decade. Look at the 90s compared to the 80s and the 80s compared to the 70s.
Well, yeah, my comment earlier, Doctor, we're not supposed to notice these level of changes in our short little lives, but we are. And that's meaningful. It means something unnatural. Abnormal is going on. West of the Rockies, is that right?
That's absolutely right.
You're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Hello, this is Olin in Culver City.
Hey, Olin.
Listening on KOGO.
Yes, sir.
I heard that the sun reversed its magnetic field. I was wondering, do you think that is causing the Earth to reverse its magnetic field, which will let in the solar plasma wind to burn us at zero magnetosphere?
Okay.
Well, that's interesting. You know, the idea that the Earth reverses its poles periodically is pretty well known. What's maybe a little lesser known is that there's sort of intermediate shifts that occur where the pole changes its location dramatically. Now, the question is it fast or is it slow? And these happen in relatively short intervals. A gentleman by the name of Hapgood, who was a scientist in New England, actually brought this thing forward, and what he said was that 10, 12,000 years ago, the polar location was right at the bottom of Hudson Bay. Now, think about that relative to the ice sheet moving through the Midwest. It makes a lot more sense.
I have in front of me an Associated Press story, Dateline San Francisco. It says, report, : Earth's magnetic field fading.
Yep.
Slight chance of flipping magnetic poles.
Yep.
And that's, I've got the whole story here, and I'll hold it for next couple of days for the audience. But, I mean, here they are beginning to consider this, Doctor.
Yep, and the polar vortices, which a report came out in an Alaskan story in the north, is actually slowing down. The circular motion is slowing down, which indicates, again, a dramatic change is about to take place. What is that change, and how fast is it? You know, there's this big controversy in sciences that say, oh, these cataclysms, you know, they're not cataclysms. They happen over thousands and thousands or millions of years. Well, the fact is polar shifts have happened at 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, 80,000 years ago. That's pretty recent.
And in that process of polar flip for the Earth, there is a period, is there not, where what he mentioned, the Earth's magnetic field, essentially for a period, goes to zero.
Right, and the question is, if it's gradual over time, we're in some serious trouble. If it's cataclysmic and rather rapid, the exposure is going to be limited, but it's going to have profound effects.
But if we had a 20-year zero-gravity period of time, that would be...
Sayonara, everyone.
Sayonara, yes, indeed. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Yes, New Orleans.
Yes, sir.
I'm an ex-Air Force intelligence officer.
Are you?
And you really need to talk to me, Art, because I was stationed at Bentwaters, and I know a lot about that Rendlesham deal.
Okay.
We need to have a long, private conversation on the phone sometime.
Why private?
Well, I have certain exposure legally.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Well, you see, we were just talking about that earlier. See, I'm not sure I want certain exposure legally, and it sounds like you're going to dump it on me.
Well, no, but they can harass you more than anything else.
Yes, they can.
Yeah, here's the point, though. There are three BMUs sites, which are ballistic missile early warning sites, in the world. One's located in Alaska. This is not classified.
All right, thank you.
There are three of them. One's in Alaska. One's in Flyingsdales Moors, Scotland, and one is at Orford Ness, which backs up to Rendlesham Forest, which backs up to Bentwaters and Woodbridge.
All right.
These things are huge antennas, about 20 or 30 acres in an area and about 500 feet high because they're over the horizon radar. And they emit enormous amounts of energy. But guess what? And I found this out because I'm right next door to one when I was stationed over there.
Yeah.
When they built these things, all right, before they turned them on, guess what those acres and acres worth of cable did?
What?
Sucked in energy.
Oh.
Just like your antenna.
Oh.
That's how the Air Force got the idea for HAARP, because when they built the BMUs, the things would practically glow in the dark because they were sucking in so much energy.
Dr. Begich?
Well, I have not heard this before.
But it's logical, isn't it?
Yeah, it does make perfect sense. And again, when you're looking at these systems, you know, why did they locate HAARP in Alaska? They wanted to be close to where the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth, because it's easier to pump energy in, and maybe it's easier to draw energy off. You know, it's an interesting question.
Well, as you built to achieve one, you would likely notice the other, as he was pointing out.
Absolutely. So it's interesting. I'll watch in the literature to see what might appear in this area, because this does make good sense.
Okay, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Begich.
Hi, Art, and to your guest, too. This is Colin Green from Visalia, California.
Okay, well, I can't let you use your last name on the air.
Sorry,
what's your first name?
Colin.
Colin is calling. Yes, okay, Colin.
And
rock
like
and roll.
I'd like to say hi to my mom, too. She'd appreciate it.
Hey, Mom. All right, Colin, to the question.
Out here in the Visalia area, my wife and I have over the past couple months and several other people have seen something like a shooting star going either northerly or westerly, and it's like a yellow or yellow and green colored light.
Oh, yes.
And it's about 500 feet wide, and it goes super fast. And I've called a UFO reporting place, but it's more like a testing thing. And, and there's been other people that have seen it, too.
All right. Does it come from a specific location?
When I seen it about 9:30 at night a couple of months ago, it was coming from east to west. And I guess from, like, southerly place. And I'm not sure if it's, like, from the Edwards Air Force Base down in Barstow area or
gotcha.
What.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. So much of this is it's hard to know what to do with reports like that. But if, in fact, we are testing this sort of thing, then those kinds of reports would be...
Yeah, those are the kinds of things you'd be hearing about.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and again, it's a tough to put it all together, because when you're making observations without the full information, they're just observations. When you collect enough of them up and they start to fit a pattern, then you can start to analyze them in a different way and start to knock out what the possibilities are. Like in this case, the first thing I would look at is the timing, and I would look at satellite movement to see whether or not that might have been something that you were seeing. I would look at all of the possibilities that would be logical first and try and eliminate those and narrow it down. And then you might get to something a little bit closer to the facts, because oftentimes people jump to conclusions without eliminating those things, when many times it is exactly those things.
All right, Doctor, we're woefully out of time here. If they want to learn more about HAARP and about the energy weapons and things we've been talking about tonight, you've written a lot. What do you recommend they read first?
Angels Don't Play This HAARP is now in its 8th printing. It is the most detailed material on this project. It's also translated in a number of languages. Following that would be Earth Rising the Revolution, which has some updates of some significance on the HAARP system and on weather control. And those are available through us at 888-690-1277.
Do that again. Always give numbers at least twice. Are you ready, folks? Okay, go ahead, Doctor.
888-690-1277.
Okay. We will obviously continue to have you back from time to time, if you're willing.
Absolutely. Anytime that you would like me to come back, I'm always available for you, Art. I always enjoy being on with you. It's a great way to get this story out. And fact of the matter is, that's how it ended up in the European Parliament. It was one of your listeners that put our information in front of Tom Spencer and eventually resulted in some of the good changes that we hope are on the horizon.
Good night. Good night, my friend.
Good night. Have a great one.
Take care. A great one indeed. And by the way, I will be back tomorrow evening for another Coast, as well as Monday for George. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, in the middle of the night, when it's dark, with Coast to Coast AM. See you tomorrow night.